Right. We're all here. Our target tonight, gentlemen, is a German radar station.
Now, we don't expect too much opposition. You shouldn't run into flak. The armed night fighter, of course, is always possible. Now, we shall be jamming all along the coast, and two destroyers will make a dummy run up here. Weather. Forecast over the targets. Fine and clear. Any more questions?
No, sir.
Right. Take off. 00:45. I'll leave you, Grant, to the details of the crew briefing. Good luck, chaps.
Thank you, sir.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to the Bristol Politics Show on the 16th of January 2026, streaming from a corner of freedom close by Bristol city centre. Don't believe a word we say, but I will try to share moments of clarity from Bristol's Templar Port turned merchant venturer's fiefdom in the City of London's Masonic Empire of Lies. We're on talkradio.org.uk stream, on djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, holylandradio.com between 11 a.m. and 2:30 p.m. Central Time, 87.7 FM in West Sweden, Wisconsin, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from GitHub and Apple App Store, but not the evil Google Play. Well, not quite live. Having to pre-record this just a half hour or so before broadcast. Just running it a little bit tight. Because Dave's away, and will be until the first show in February. So no Martin. Maybe a bit of chit-chat with Martin next week. But anyway, I've got an absolutely packed show, and very much up-to-date, super relevant. Well, I would say that, wouldn't I? This week we'll be looking at particularly at Iran, but also got a special thing on reform, because there's loads of stuff. They've come out punching and fighting after the Christmas break. This obviously with family deciding, yes, okay, I've had enough of the AI political party politics. And of course it's the same AI nonsense going on within our press. So the idea is that both in politics and the media, all these important democratic institutions, that it could be switched over to AI without anybody even noticing. So I better run quickly through what we've got this week. And we're going to be starting with Iran, which is important, I think, to get through the firewall. Let's have a listen to Press TV, which I go on quite regularly, and which is totally banned in Britain for all sorts of spurious reasons by Bilderbergers called Ofcom. And so let's have a listen to the what's really caused the street fighting. They had a thing called the Rial, which is their currency, a crisis after Christmas and into the new year. People were protesting on the streets because they have runaway inflation. But what's obviously happened at the tail end of last week, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, is the demonstrators suddenly found weapons lying around, maybe, or there was explosives, and people came to join them. And those people are quite clearly, as the Americans and the Israelis have said, agents who are in there. We haven't heard much about that on the UK press, but here's Saeed Mohammed Mirandi on Press TV giving a good roundup of what's been going on in Iran.
And now we have an in-studio guest with us, Dr. Saeed Mohammed Mirandi, university professor and political analyst out of the University of Tehran here in the Iranian capital, sitting next to us. Professor, always a pleasure to have you join us in our broadcast here. It's been obviously a very disheartening few days for our countrymen and supporters of Iran. Let's start with your state of mind, watching parts of the country burn, the violence, security forces and civilians killed, public and private property destroyed. I'm sure it's shaken all of us up, but there's certain sadness, certain frustration, anger, melancholy. How do you feel today?
Well, obviously, it's been painful, especially on Thursday and Friday when the riots got very bad. We have to remember, during the first couple of days, the protests were peaceful. The police had nothing to do with them. People were protesting the fall of the Rial. Business people were worried because when the Rial falls, you sell your goods and then you don't have enough money to buy new goods. So they had legitimate concerns and fears, and the government acknowledged that they had to deal with it. But then when the infiltration began, and then gradually the violence grew, and then on Thursday and Friday We saw the massive destruction, tens of fire engines and ambulances and tens of public buses and private property, and that young nurse who was in the clinic, and they burned down the clinic, and she escaped to the top floor, and even there she burned to a crisp. All these are very painful. But just like the 12-day war, I think it did show both the sinister nature of the West, because we have Pompeo saying that, you know, Mossad is on the streets, even though Western pundits like to pretend that he didn't say it. We saw the Mossad say it in Persian in their statement. The West again pretends it's not, it didn't happen. And then more recently we saw Channel 14 of Israel say that foreign governments, meaning the Israelis and the Americans obviously, they're bringing in arms. But Western media and pundits pretend as if none of this is happening. I think the awareness that this is creating among Iranian people actually is good for the country in the long run, the awareness. And the fact that we saw so many people come to the streets across the country, the West tried to pretend it's AI. They claim to have all the facts about who died and who died in the riots and so on, but then they cannot confirm these huge numbers where you had rolling coverage. That, again, shows the hypocrisy and the dishonesty of the West. So it's painful, it's hurtful, just like the 12-day war, but I think it has shown ordinary Iranians that the West is only trying to divide the country, to harm the country, and it's brought people together. Hopefully, we'll see better days ahead. Of course, many believe, and I'm one of them, I believe that the currency manipulation was carried out by the United States to create unrest, and then so that these groups of rioters would get involved. And you know, when the police get deals with rioters, then you have organized crime that comes out, it gets worse by nature. So, and some of the hurt and injuries and perhaps deaths, I don't know, were as a result of, for example, they attacked marketplaces where the police weren't there, and then the shop owners, they paid for people to protect them, and then they got into fights. Lots of things were happening. But I think in the days ahead, it's quite possible that the United States will carry out strikes against Iran. And I think the unity that we now see among Iranians as on Monday, that is something that I think is will strengthen the president, will strengthen the armed forces in the challenging days ahead, and it will, I have no doubt, even though they try to pretend, they try to downplay the massive rallies on Monday, but I have no doubt that their intelligence agencies are monitoring, and they're probably thinking to themselves that this country is very united, and waging some sort of conflict with Iran is going to have problems, and it could change the. If there is a conflict, it could shorten it. If it could stop it, I don't know what will happen. But I think that national unity and that strength and people coming together is not good news for the empire.
Right, and it wasn't just Monday, wasn't it? There's multi layers of people turning out for funeral processions, thousands upon hundreds of thousands. To bid farewell to people who put their lives in the line of duty to try to restore order to the country. People who came out to reaffirm their allegiance to their government, to their authorities. Another layer of people coming out to deplore the foreign-backed hands involved in these riots. So there's multiple layers to why people turn out in such mass numbers, isn't there?
You know, you're absolutely correct. Today I wanted to go to the funeral, and 100 martyrs today, I'm sure you discussed it at length. And then the West calls these riots peaceful, and you have all, you know, hundreds of people who were martyred. You had some say between 300 and 400 officers of the law, including the Basij and the riot control police and the ordinary police, were murdered. That's not, you know, in the United States, if one police officer is killed, they'll make it a huge issue. But you're right. I wanted to go actually to the funeral today before coming here, and I saw there was so much traffic. That I was fearful that I'd miss an interview because I don't have internet like everyone else. I have to come and use your organization's internet. So I did a few I thought it would be late, so I had to leave. And and also, one of my close relatives, his neighbor, and this is anecdotal, but I think it's reflective of life. he went to one of these protests or riots, and it was on like near Ashrafi Esfahani and Charay Punak, around there, and he said that these guys, some of these people, I don't know which mosque he was talking about, they wanted to attack the mosque, and then ordinary people who were like around them to know, and they got into a big fist fight and a big fight with each other. Some of those people who were sort of on the, I don't know, the, you know, in and both in and outside of the riots, they said, no, this is too much. So, and then he, this neighbor of one of my close relatives, came home and said, no, this is really bad news. So while there's a lot of hurt and pain, but I think that there's also a lot of awareness as well. Hopefully we'll have better days ahead. Hopefully the awareness across the globe after Palestine and the genocide and how the West behaved, that will cause people across the world to question all the narratives about Iran. And hopefully people will be united, and the challenging days ahead will be met with strength.
And really quick, the censorship involved in Western corporate media, Doctor. I mean, you mentioned what they chose to conveniently leave out with respect to certain politicians, making certain, engaging in certain rhetoric, basically showing their hand in how involved certain agencies, Western spy agencies, are, intel agencies, were behind these riots. I want to put that question to you. It's very, what is it? Is this all about controlling the narrative, not showing the turnout of people that support the establishment, that want these riots to be done, to have peace and calm restored, show they're behind security forces in that endeavor to make that happen, and also their allegiance with the Islamic establishment? That's very conveniently left out as well.
Yes, I mean, people went to the streets on Monday to support the Constitution, to support state institutions, to support peace and stability in the country and the legitimate state. People may be unhappy about many things, the economy, the judiciary, the bureaucracy, parliament, the leader. People have all sorts of views. But that doesn't mean that people, I mean, in the West, they call that diversity and civil society. Here, there are diverse views. But when the West tries to turn people against one another and use and promote violence, I mean, this Persian language media channel, there are many which are very hostile, and they have cyber armies in Albania, they have thousands there. But Iran International, and I tweeted this clip where the host is calling for armed struggle. And this is a London-based news channel. And so basically, from London, they're waging war against Iran. And then you see the U.S. president telling people to take over government buildings. Yet the West consider this to be normal, because they see themselves as having special privileges, as having special rights, as being superior to the... If we say that the American people should take over government institutions, how would the reaction be? But for them to say this to us, it's normal, because they see themselves as above and beyond the rest of us. And one final thing. You know, the height of the riots were on Thursday and Friday. When they cut off the internet, on, I think, early Friday morning. I'm not good at dates. I'm very terrible at these things. But I think it was early Friday morning. Within hours, within 24 hours, it started to collapse. And the reason was that all these different groups, I mean, not everyone, some young kids, you know, gathered in the excitement foolishly, their parents foolish, some of them believed in whatever it was they were doing. Others were just passing by, and some people were organized crime, using the opportunity to do what they do. But as this was happening, we saw that on Friday, as the internet, the whole thing began to collapse across the country. Mm. Why? If it was spontaneous, it would continue. But if they're in contact with abroad and they're organizing how to do things, and they lose that contact, then they can't continue. And that's why the last 3 days have been very normal and quiet, as you've seen. You live in Tehran. Online, they're portraying it as if it's riots every day, but nothing is happening. And it's all because of the internet. Also, right now, they're keeping the internet, I think, as it is, which is difficult for all of us. But because probably if the Americans attack, and they usually gather intelligence through digital means, and so the Iranians want to keep them as in the dark as much as possible. So it'll probably continue for a while.
And before we let you go, Professor, I appreciate you having me. I know it's been a long day for you. And I had reservations about asking this, but you notice my producer just came and doubled down
on me
asking this.
Because
this is real controversial, and I got to really commend you that you stayed completely composed, better than everyone else involved in that broadcast on Piers Morgan. This lady, Goldie Agamori, and my naivety gets the better of me. I don't know her like a lot of people do, but she said this is Mohammad Marandi. He is the Joseph Goebbels of the terrorist Islamic dictatorship. It's ironic. She won't mention Yisrael Katz or Yoav Gallant or Benjamin Netanyahu after 72,000 fatalities in this genocide in Gaza.
Maybe hundreds of thousands. We don't know how many people
as the Joseph Goebbels, but somehow she makes that conflation with... Anyway, and then she said, today on Pierce Uncensored, I told Mohammed to his face that when Iran is free, his pinky finger will be the biggest piece of him left after Iranians are done with him. I really don't want to ask you this question because I don't want to stir up and elicit any kind of, you know, salty or bitter sentiments within you. But this kind of stuff, what's this all about? And how did it make you feel? And why should this even be allowed with someone of your stature?
Well, I'm just an ordinary citizen, and I defend the country because I feel I'm responsible, and I always say what I believe to be the truth. And you working here, you do the same. You believe in what you do. We, the people, your colleagues here. This woman is basically proving a point, and that is that these rioters are violent. And she is expressing this. She's saying that we want to tear these people apart into bits and pieces, just like ISIS, just like, you know, the most, you know, just like the Zionists. And while, you know, doesn't intimidate me or create fear, but I think she's proving a point that when we say that these riots were violent, she is a representative of this mentality. She doesn't know Iran, apparently, from what I heard. She left Iran when she was one. But the fact that she can say this sort of thing on a recorded program... And by the way, I was supposed to be one-on-one with Piers Morgan. His producers, because I said I would not go on if it's not one-on-one. And Piers Morgan and his team, they agreed. And then they brought her in to question Monday's rallies. She was saying, no, these are all fake footage. It's AI. You had rolling coverage throughout the day here. I mean, anyone can see that it was the real thing. But anyway, the dishonesty of Piers Morgan, but that's Western media. But the fact that this was a recorded program, and she was allowed to say this, and they showed it, I think it's... And the fact that Elon Musk lets these people say these things and get away with it, whereas I've lost my Instagram account for showing a picture years ago, showing a picture of my commander during the war who, because of chemical weapons, was dying. And they shut my account. My Facebook account was also shut down for something similar, some like nothing. And I only have a Twitter account, which is heavily shadow banned. But these people can go and say whatever they like, threaten you with murder, torture, and it's fine because that's okay in the West. But if we say that there's a genocide in Gaza on BBC, then they'll cut us off or cut us short or say that this is controversial or...
Anti-Semitic.
Or anti-Semitic.
Always a pleasure, Doctor.
You're very
long. Thank you for exhausting over 20 minutes of your time with us. Professor Mohammad Marandi, joining us here in our Tehran studios.
So that's Saeed Mohammad Marandi on Banned in Britain Press TV. But anyway, look, Trump. An interview with President Trump happened last Friday as this was all going on. And I think it's well worth having a listen to what he had to say.
Given what has happened in Venezuela, the threats against Colombia, the discussions about taking Greenland, buying Greenland, however you're framing this right now, is there anything that you think can constrain your power on the world stage if you believe that something is against national security? Do you see any checks on your power on the world stage? Is there anything that could stop you if you wanted to?
Yeah, there's one thing, my own morality, my own mind, It's the only thing that can stop.
And, not international
and that's
law.
Very good. I don't need international law. I'm not looking to hurt people. I'm not looking to kill people. I've ended, remember this, I've ended 8 wars. Nobody else has ever done that. I've ended 8 wars and didn't get the Nobel Peace Prize. Pretty amazing. Obama got it. He was there for a few weeks and he got it. He didn't even know why he got it. They asked him, why did he get it? He was unable to answer the question. I ended 8 wars. If you look at those wars, these were tough wars to end, too. And let me tell you, India and Pakistan were going at it. As you know, they were going at it. But that was 1 of 8. But we ended 8 strong wars, some going on for more than 30 years.
But do you feel your administration needs to abide by international law on the global stage?
Yeah, I do. I do. But it depends what your definition of international law is. But the answer is I do. But we have to keep the United States safe. We have to keep parts of the world safe that we feel responsible for. NATO is not feared by Russia or China at all, not even a little bit.
So that was a New York Times interview with Donald Trump last week. I talk about it a bit in an interview with The World Today, which is this week. I've not heard about them before, but I got a call from Australia to do an early morning interview with them. And who else was on it? Well, it's Dr. David Miller, the sacked professor of sociology from Bristol University, who's one of the leaders of the movement against the Zionists in the UK. So let's have a listen to David Miller's take on what was going on. Donald Trump, you know, obviously saying, well, you know, my morality is all that's sort of governing things. Well, that's not good enough, matey. So what's been going on in Iran, anyhow?
The former US Secretary of State and director of the CIA has made a name for himself in the last week or so, boasting that Mossad agents are there, which what would any government do? Seriously, what would any government do if they're confronted with violent protests and the people who are backing the protests are bragging that there's foreign intelligence agents among them helping to organise the protest? You're going to provoke a reaction.
Well, you're right to point to Pompeo's message, but it's not just Pompeo bragging. The Mossad have been saying openly on Israeli media that they're there, and that what they're saying is that when the regime, as they call it, falls, they will do exactly the same to Iran as they did to Syria, which is to take out all of their military defensive capability. So that's what the Mossad are planning. They've got people on the ground in Iran, as we have seen, from various different groups. They've also recruited a whole host of Afghan refugees who are the cheapest ones to recruit inside Iran, so it's said. So that this is a Mossad-inspired, directed, orchestrated, in quotes, uprising, which, of course, is where all sorts of propaganda is being circulated. There is 1.5 million people on the streets. It's not protests, it's revolution. Well, we know now that that is a fantasy. At best, they had 12,000 people on the streets a few days ago. That was the high point. And the protests have more or less entirely finished now. When I say the protests are finished, I mean the anti-government protests orchestrated by the Mossad. The protests in Iran haven't finished because, of course, we've seen several 1 million man and woman marches in Tehran and indeed in Isfahan, in Mashhad, and in other places inside Iran, all of which are there supporting the government and opposing US and Israeli interventions in their country. So that's the situation we see. Of course, the propaganda about the 20,000 deaths, well, at maximum, if you have 12,000 people in one day out demonstrating, it's difficult to imagine how 20,000 deaths could have come from that. And of course, although we've seen pictures of body bags, the reality is that 2/3, roughly, of those bodies of dead people have been caused by the Mossad assets, including, of course, 3-year-old girl, an 8-year-old girl, nurses and teachers, and other civilians who have been killed by these anti-government protesters. And then, of course, let's remember, imagine this happened in the UK or in Australia. Significant numbers of local police and volunteer people's defence forces have been killed. There have been attacks on mosques. 35 mosques have been burnt to the ground. They've been attacking ancient libraries. These are not the activities of civil rights protesters. These are the activities of foreign intervention attempting to destroy the country. There is no way in which actual Iranians would be burning mosques. It is simply impossible that that would be the case. So what we see is an orchestrated attempt to destroy the country, and it's an attempt which has now, it seems, come to an end. But of course, it's in the context which you mentioned at the beginning about Donald Trump. And I would say a few words about that before I stopped now. And of course, Donald Trump is doing a whole variety of things. And it turns out, when you look at these things, that they have a connection, all of them, to the Zionist entity, to Israel. We saw that in Venezuela with the Zionist oligarch Paul Singer making billions of dollars from the oil contracts which he was given shortly before they kidnapped Maduro. We see that in Greenland, where there are Zionist oligarchs attempting to pressure the Greenland government, the Greenlandic government, by investing in Greenland. And we see that also, of course, in Iran, where it's perfectly plain, as everybody knows, that the Zionists have it as their top priority to remove the government of Iran, because the government of Iran, let's be clear and remember, is the main threat that there is to the genocide in Gaza. It's the main country which is willing and able, and has been willing and able for 47 years, to take on the Zionists, not just diplomatically, but actually militarily. And that's the top priority for Israel, is to destroy Iran. And when Trump talked about acting against Iran, he's simply doing the bidding of Netanyahu and the genocide heirs in Tel Aviv.
Tony Gosling, a freelance investigative journalist who's now awake, fourth cup of coffee, very early from Newark. He doesn't get up until the crack of midday. Something like that. Tony, can you just tell me quickly your thoughts on what you've just heard, and also your thoughts on the reporting from legacy media, and also on social media and also independent media? Seems to be a lot of, as we would say in Australia, a lot of cow manure as part of that reporting. Would you agree? And what's your impressions?
Well, I mean, it's difficult to find more on the present situation to say about this than David has just done. He's done a pretty good roundup there. But you have to understand also that Netanyahu has been doing this thing from Israel directly over the last couple of years since the genocide began in Gaza, making these direct appeals to the population of Iran. Which is something, there's something quite bizarre about this, where he's saying, you know, everything will get better for you in Iran if you just topple your own country. Now, I don't think this is really aimed at the population in Iran at all. It's aimed at an English-speaking European and US audience. And he said about these present protests, he says, I want you to imagine how your life could be different if Iran was free. So this is Netanyahu speaking. Now, that's actually, I think, again, aimed at a Western audience, an English-speaking Western audience. This is aimed at the so-called riot. You know, well, they don't even call them rioters. These are protesters. We're not hearing about riots, which is what's been going on over there. So the use of language is specific, isn't it? That's one aspect of this, where we're seeing actually something which is largely not to do with Iran. It's to do with preparing a Western population for a specific narrative, which is all about how terrible things are for the poor Iranians and how they're uprising. And this is one of the characteristics of this modern television age, where most of us are just going about our lives, and the TV people are trusted to show us what's going on in other parts of the world. Trump has also talking about all this, saying about Venezuela specifically, but this applies to all these interventions the US are up to around the world. He's saying, my own morality, my own mind, is the only thing that can stop me. That's what his statement last Friday, I think it was, about Venezuela. And when he was New York Times were asking him about what he was up to by kidnapping a foreign leader. Actually, I wouldn't even use the word that word kidnap about Maduro. He's taken Maduro hostage in order to close deals with the remains of the Venezuelan government and to, you know, with the blockade that he's doing on their trade. So he's basically saying that, you know, you've got to do as we say. And he also says, I don't need international law when he's talking to the New York Times. Anyway, international law really is all about, depends on your definition of what international law is. So he's saying he is the guy to define international law. Now, this is a New York property speculator who's made his money through dodgy deals on big buildings and plots of land. In one of the most shark-infested waters in the world. So this, I'm afraid, it, I mean, he's no JFK, he's no Kennedy. We, you know, if it comes to nuclear confrontation around the world, this is the guy who thinks that he can close a deal by imposing his own version of morality, his own version of international law on the rest of the world. So we're in a pretty dangerous place, I think, with this guy in charge. So we're right now, you know, he's also saying, keep protesting, help is on the way to these people who have now pretty much finished their protest. Many of them have been arrested, apprehended or melted back into the population. And it threatening, obviously, to intervene in Iran. Now, this is an absolutely horrific state of affairs for the world. So we're on the edge, really, aren't we? We're on the edge of a potential enormous war with nuclear-armed Israel, too, being involved in this, potentially. And obviously, the temptation on Iran is for them to do what the North Koreans and others have done, is that they may have to develop nuclear weapons in order to keep the United States and Israel at bay, who are quite clearly trying to put them in the line of many of these other countries that have had these Orange Revolution style regime change, like Tunisia, the regime change in Libya, Syria, and of course that was around the Arab Spring 2011, Egypt, that where there was a overthrowing the government due to street protests. But returning back to a kind of US military style rule in Egypt and Ukraine in 2014, the Maidan Square Orange Revolution style takeover by the United States and the European Union, mostly the United States. So that's what they're trying to do in Iran. And the Anglo-Zionist Empire is putting us on a military knife edge here with a potential Third World War, as well as, of course, leaving us in the lurch with massive debt and a economic nightmare. So really, much of this, I think, is targeted at Western populations rather than just the people of Iran. And that's the treachery of the Western press, all lined up with this same sort of narrative, really to bamboozle their own people and trick them, is absolutely appalling. So thank you very much for doing broadcasts like this to try and you know, puncture that bubble a bit.
Yeah, we often puncture bubbles, but hasn't got as very far. Let me tell you that. I just want to ask David, if you don't mind, the greatest threat to, there's two questions here. The greatest threat to peace in Iran, the mullahs, or is it the US, or is it Israel? And part two of this: do the people of Iran want a regime change in the first place?
Well, I think the term the mullahs is problematic. I mean, look, as you said at the beginning, this Iran is a complex society. I've been there a couple of times. I was last there last May. I have contacts inside Iran who I have been communicating with, even despite this blackout. And it's a complex society in a number of ways. It's a large society. It has a history, but it's complex in particular in relation to its current politics. I mean, we have, when people talk about the mullahs or the ayatollahs, it's a society in which Islam plays a significant role. It's called the Islamic Republic of Iran, and it was Islam as the religion which formed the basis for the political ideas for those who took over the society and ejected the Western-backed puppet, the Shah. Now, currently, of course, when people talk about return to democracy, I saw Priti Patel on your show, on your news item at the top there, talking about the return of democracy to Iran. Well, Iran is a democracy. As everybody knows, when President Raisi was what looks like now assassinated just the other year, they elected a new president, President Pezeshkian. Now, Pezeshkian is not, quote, a mullah. He's not an imam. He's not a Muslim cleric. He is, in fact, a reformist. And so, of course, there is, inside Iran, a conflict between those who are style themselves reformists, the liberals, the neoliberals, who want to bring in reforms and who want to make a deal with America. In fact, many of the people who are associated with that tendency have been trying to communicate with Trump and say we want to have some kind of agreement. And they are opposed, of course, by the principalists, the ones who believe in the revolution, who believe that there is no possible deal that can be done with America or indeed with the Zionists, and that actually there's an existential threat to the Republic, which can only be resolved with the removal of the Zionist colony in the Levant and the final defeat of Zionism in West Asia. So, and those principles, of course, represented most obviously by the leader, the supreme leader, who doesn't have a formal political position, but is the theological, if you like, spiritual leader of the country. That's Imam Khamenei. Now, that's a conflict internal in Iran, and it's a conflict which is ongoing. But when you say, do the people in Iran want regime change? Well, I mentioned before that at best, 12,000 people on the streets in one day, many of whom paid by the Mossad or direct Mossad agents, and then followed by million-man marches in several cities in support of the government, in which the reformists, including President Pezeshkian, took part. So that's really quite different from talking about regime change. Of course, not even Pezeshkian believes openly, at least, in regime change. The vast bulk of the population of Iran are loyal to the Islamic Republic and have been made more loyal by the attacks on it by the Zionists in the last couple of years, as we saw the unprovoked attack by the Zionists on the Iranian consulate in Damascus during the process there, which led, of course, to the 12-day war, in which eventually, after 12 days, the Zionists sued for peace, and the Americans pressured the Iranian government to stop firing missiles because the missiles were being so effective. So we have a situation where Iran is under existential threat by the Zionists. Probably there will be further attacks, maybe involving the Americans very shortly. But it's not clear from outside observers that these will be successful for Israel and for America, because of course, if the war drags on, it's not impossible that the Iranians would win that war. And let's remember that the kind of imperial overreach we've seen in previous American interventions in Vietnam, in Afghanistan, and indeed previously in Iran. I mean, when I was in Iran last year, I went to the American embassy, or I should say the former American embassy, where there is now a museum, which is called, I believe, the Den of Spying Museum, right? And they've put on display everything that was in the museum when the students took it over in 1980, just after the revolution, including they waited for 2.5 hours to get into the embassy because the staff had locked the doors. They went over the fences and they were locked outside. In the 2.5 hours, the CIA station inside the embassy were furiously shredding documents. And they got in after 2.5 hours. And being students, they had nothing else to do apart from keep 60 Americans hostage. They reconstructed from the shredded documents all of the original documents and then published them in a 28-volume series, which is still legal for American citizens to own to this day. So that was an imperial overreach. And of course, the Americans lost then. And so it's not very clear that either the Americans, given the advanced nature of drone warfare and missile warfare now, or the Zionists can beat Iran, because it's a significant and serious impediment to the continuation of genocide in the Levant. So I don't think that we're going to see regime change there. The people don't want regime change. What we're seeing is the attempt to defend the gains, as the Zionists would see it, of the genocide. And of course, they are the hampering of Hezbollah in Lebanon, the destruction of the Assad government in Syria, and the bringing in of an ISIS and Suits government, which now has a formal, quote, fusion agreement with Israel. So it effectively is a Zionist vassal. the standing down of the Iraqi resistance. They haven't defeated Yemen yet, and they haven't defeated Iran yet, but they think that they are winning. And it's only Iran, really, with the help of Yemen, that can defeat them.
Can I just ask one more thing, David, before I pop over to Robert? This, you know, the information that we are receiving, or the West is receiving, the rest of the world is receiving, seems out of the rule book, the 101, how to do good information operations.
Well, let's remember that Bell Pottinger came into Iraq after shock and awe, or after the removal of Hussein, and they had a long-term process where they eventually lost, and Bell Pottinger were brought in to do that. And of course, in the case, for example, of Syria, the lead agency in that case was, of course, MI6, the British Foreign Intelligence Agency, which has a whole host of PR firms on roster who were involved in supporting what they called the moderate armed opposition, which turned out to be Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and who they then put in power. But let's remember that MI6 apparently has an office in Jalani's presidential palace, and that's why, of course, the agreement with Israel is called a fusion agreement, because that's the term which comes from British intelligence doctrine. So look, of course, there are all sorts of agencies involved. In this specific case of Iran presently, the numbers that you're seeing, 12,000 dead, 20,000 dead, however many it is, these are numbers which are coming, as someone, I think was it Tony pointed out, no, it was Robert, you pointed out, these are numbers which are coming from organizations which are based in the US and sometimes in the UK, and which are funded by an organization called the National Endowment for Democracy. And as everybody knows who's paid any attention to this stuff, this is a CIA front. This is an organization which its own leader said was created to do overtly what the CIA had previously done covertly, and that is to fund propaganda and information operations around the world. And of course, they're big on talking about the agency of the Iranian people, and this is people who are, you know, who are funded directly as agents of the CIA in Iran. So, of course, we know that the CIA are involved, but this is an operation which is being directed by and in the interests of the Zionists preeminently. And of course, they are engaged in their own information operations. The Israeli paper Haaretz just the other day had a large expose of the millions of dollars which are going into Zionist Israeli bot armies to flood the internet with the kind of stuff that we're getting. And the sad thing about it is not just that the mainstream media, legacy media, as you referred to it, is parroting this stuff, meaning that if you pay attention to the mainstream media, you have an impossibly distorted view of what's going on in Iran. But the sad thing about it seems to me, is that large sections of the left in the UK, in Western Europe, in the US, and indeed internationally, have absorbed key elements of that. And they say, oh, of course, we don't want a regime change, but nevertheless, the terrible regime in Iran, and the terrible regime in Iran is the world's predominant and preeminent anti-imperialist nation. And it bears no resemblance whatsoever to the kinds of stories which one hears about it. And in particular, of course, people say, oh, what about women's rights? Well, you know, the rights of women in Iran to be involved in professional occupations are way in excess as a proportion of women in the UK or in Australia. And the number of Iranian women in Iran currently with OnlyFans accounts is tending towards zero in a way which is not the case in Western society. So look, I think, of course, we're seeing information operations. And what I would hope is that people try and find out more about Iran. It's a very complex society. It has its own politics. And you can have all sorts of views inside Iran about what the politics are, none of which will go anywhere near the idea that the Zionists should be taking it over.
So that's Dr. David Miller and me talking on The World Today this week. The whole point, I suppose, of talking about it on there is to explain just what we're not hearing here about Iran. Obviously, this is part of the Pax Judaica. Maybe I should have a section every week about Pax Judaica. The idea is that the Israelis and the Americans are conspiring for regime change in Iran. This is all illegal, isn't it? But where's the UN? The UN is agency, the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, is complaining about Iran, not complaining about the nuclear weapons that the Israelis have got. So all rather perverse, and our minds are being bent. So Venezuela is a big part of what Trump's been up to, Reed Brody is a war crimes prosecutor who popped up on the BBC to talk about the legalities of Venezuela.
In Venezuela, lots of accusations of human rights violations, crimes against humanity and so on. When you put that against the manner in which the US went in and captured him in this way, what does that all mean?
Well, as somebody who spent my life helping victims bring brutal leaders to justice, it's always good to see an abusive dictator in handcuffs. And Maduro obviously should be held responsible before an independent court for the alleged crimes committed against the Venezuelan people. But that's not what this is about, and it cannot be done in this way. I mean, this operation was a clear violation of the most fundamental rule of international law, the UN Charter's prohibition on the use of force, except in self-defense or pursuant to a Security Council mandate. I mean, this brings us back to the world where might makes right, a return to the law of the jungle. And once that door is open, it applies to anyone. I mean, if the United States can do this, Russia can do it, China can do it too. I mean, unfortunately, this was a manifestly illegal operation.
And with those legal questions over the operation, will that in any way jeopardize the potential for a conviction here?
Well, certainly, first of all, under international law, a sitting head of state has immunity from prosecution in the domestic courts of a foreign country. I mean, the United States recognizes that rule. And paradoxically, the U.S. Supreme Court recently said that even former American presidents enjoy broad immunity for official acts. But the U.S. is likely to argue in court that Maduro wasn't the legitimate president of Venezuela. And it's quite possible that the court will defer to the president on this issue, as it did 36 years ago when the U.S. captured Manuel Noriega. But internationally, that doesn't fly. I mean, the highest French court recently said that if immunity were made conditional on a country recognizing the ruler, that would essentially vitiate the rule of immunity. But the precedent being set here is extremely dangerous. I mean, imagine another country claiming the right to arrest a U.S. president. I mean, Donald Trump, for instance, is presumptively responsible for the premeditated murder on the high seas in the 35 or so strikes against boats in the Caribbean that have resulted in over 115 deaths. Now, can Venezuela or an international court just come in and snatch President Trump for these alleged crimes? So that's the world that this logic creates, and it's a world without rules, and it's a very dangerous world.
Now, these are all issues presumably we'll hear debated at the UN Security Council emergency meeting tomorrow. But in a practical sense, does it make a difference? This has happened now. That precedent that you're discussing has happened now.
Well, that's right. I mean, it makes, and we are now in a very dangerous world. I mean, the most powerful country in the world, one of the five permanent members of the Security Council, has just said the rules don't matter. We can do what we want. America for the Americans is Trump was invoking the Monroe Doctrine, which obviously is not international law. But, you know, what does this mean? So the U.S. has its sphere of influence, and U.S. can do what it wants. And then Russia has its sphere of influence, which includes Ukraine. And what else does it include? And then China has its sphere of influence. It can do what it wants. So I think, you know, this is, I mean, it's done, or actually it's not done, because, it looks like the U.S. is going to continue to occupy and run Venezuela. But certainly the taking of Maduro is done, but I think it sets a very dangerous precedent.
And just on that, in terms of running Venezuela, as we heard from President Trump yesterday, the Supreme Court in Venezuela has said that the Vice President, Kelsey Rodriguez, is now the acting president, essentially. So it would appear that there hasn't been regime change. So in a way, what do you see as the point of this mission?
Well, we don't know what the point is. I mean, they talk about drugs, but Obviously, Venezuela only accounts for a small fraction of drugs coming into the United States. And just last month, President Trump pardoned the former Honduran president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was serving a 45-year sentence in that very court from those very prosecutors for running a network that brought in 500 tons of cocaine into the United States. A man who bragged about sending coke up the nose of gringos and received a $1 million bribe from El Chapo. So drugs were just a pretext. I mean, I was actually pretty surprised to hear Trump say the quiet part out loud, that the U.S. was going to take over the Venezuelan oil industry. I mean, I think that anyone anywhere can appreciate that the U.S. has absolutely no right to the oil of Venezuela, which belongs to the people of Venezuela.
Okay, lots of questions still unanswered there. We might get the answers to in the next days and weeks ahead. But for now, Reid Brody, International War Crimes Prosecutor and member of the International Commission of Jurists, thank you very much for joining us here on BBC News.
You're quite welcome.
Well, he starts off quite badly, but he gets better and better. That's Reid Brody on the BBC on Maduro Day, the day he was taken hostage by the Americans, making it pretty clear how he's dragging us down the road to complete chaos in the world, the Lords of Chaos. That's Reid Brody. So what's the point of international law? Jeremy Corbyn, Yanis Varoufakis and Malcolm Rifkin were involved in a discussion this week chaired by Bronwyn Maddox, whoever she is. But anyway, let's have a listen to what they have to say about the state of international law today. What's the point?
I'd like to bring us back to the sort of generality of international law and whether there are any alternative frameworks that actually might prove more effective at making states behave better when they're at war. Malcolm?
Well, this is a historical process. You know, before the Second World War, there was no such constraints at all, even attempted. So we had the terrible thing after
the UN Charter.
I'm talking about the League of Nations period.
Oh, sorry.
And I'm saying that, for example, during the war, when Germany bombed Coventry, we bombed Dresden. And we bombed indiscriminately.
Yeah.
And we knew that we were killing as many Germans as we could, men, women and children. And Bomber Harris defended that to the last days of his life. And many people agreed with him. So that was in the context of the middle of, I'm not defending it, but that was in the middle of a world war. It was because of these circumstances that people, particularly in Britain and America, in the Western countries, decided the time had come, not just to create a United Nations, but to create an international declaration of human rights. And whether it was in Geneva or in the UN, and that was a huge step forward, which the world had never had before. So we shouldn't get too pessimistic or too upset that it's not working perfectly. You know, when you have 180 countries in the world and there are real differences between them, it is only in the last couple of generations we've even tried to have an international legal system. And it's already achieved good progress in some areas and deep disappointments elsewhere.
Yeah. So don't let perfection be the enemy of the good, is what you're saying.
I think the history goes back longer than that, and there's a lot, you know, to do with the settlement of the First World War. That was an attempt by countries, not very successful, but something that resembled international law. All right, most of the apparatus we're talking about came in after the Second World War, but it goes back. It's been a long time since countries have said there should be no international law. So in answer to your question, I think no. There are lots and lots of international laws, but if you were to remove yourself from the principle completely, you have a free-for-all. You have countries, the stronger ones saying we're going to do what we want, and the weaker ones saying we wish there was some agreement. Can we do anything getting together in regional groups or anything to protect ourselves? It is the weaker ones who say most clearly we need the rule of law, but you take it away, you have a free-for-all.
But the use of international statutes and conventions does help people campaigning in lots of places. I mean, I've been many times to the UN Human Rights Commission, now Council, taken up individual cases there and able to quote back at the governments concerned the issue of their breaches and so on. It doesn't always solve everything, but it does mean that those demanding the freedom of people that have been wrongly imprisoned and so on have something they can quote back in their campaigning in that society. So it does help, and it does help also to expose those governments that don't do anything to try and mend their ways on irrational imprisonment, arrest, murder, torture, and so on. It doesn't solve it all, but it's a step forward that we at least have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that we do have a UN process that you can use to try and support people going through the deepest and darkest times of their lives.
And after all, some war criminals have been arrested and jailed.
Yeah, but, you know, at least if you have a democratic structure, Israel is a democracy. Its courts are independent of the government, and the courts have stopped Netanyahu on not enough occasions, but very often he has been overruled by the courts and he's been forced to accept that. So the crucial requirement is not just an international system. It is the saddest fact of the world we live in is that about half the world does not respect the rule of law domestically, never mind internationally.
All right, but even in the places it doesn't, like Russia, international law does give a basis for doing something to punish what has been done.
It's good that we can converge on the importance of international law, even if it is weak and unenforceable, because it is our legacy. As Malcolm said before, after 1945, after the horrors of the Holocaust, of the whole caboodle, the peoples of the world united and they brought themselves to the point where they agreed on international rules. They defined the difference between war and a war crime, the difference between war crime and genocide. These definitions are yardsticks by which we can measure the hypocrisy of our own leaders and other leaders. And this is essential for agitating in order to give a chance to this transformation of the international law which we have now, which is what? It is a series of principles that the bigots and the warmongers and the perpetrators disobey and the righteous cannot enforce. To convert that into a kind of United Nations that would have the capacity to act. This is a long process. Whether we will succeed or not is neither here nor there. But we have no right to wipe out this legacy because it is not being enforced.
Good. Thank you.
So that was Malcolm Rifkin, followed by Jeremy Corbyn and Yanis Varoufakis, the former Greek finance minister. Jeremy, Labour, Malcolm Rifkin, former defence secretary for the Tories, discussing all this. And, you know, I think it's pretty clear it's getting pretty bad, isn't it? Someone needs to get their finger out, otherwise we're going to have a World War III, as some people want to have. But there are some goodies around. One of them's called Peter Oborne. He's written a fantastic book, which I was plugging just before Christmas. The whole of Christianity, he thinks, is under attack.
I'm Peter Oborne, and I'm with Kegambalia, who represents Save the Ark. What is Save the Ark?
Save the Ark is a movement tasked for the preservation and the defense of the Armenian Quarter of Jerusalem.
And we're in the Armenian Quarter now.
Yes, and specifically in the Cow's Garden.
The Cow's Garden, which is also a parking lot.
Yes.
For Armenians. Now, is that the external wall of the old city?
Yes.
Beautiful. It's such a privilege.
Here, all the way through there.
Such a privilege so just to
really
be here.
Yeah, it's really a treasure in the old city of Jerusalem.
And we're in the heart of the Armenian Quarter.
Yes,
its name.
Yes. And on the highest point on Mount Zion.
The highest point?
Yes.
And how long have Armenians been here in Jerusalem?
The Armenian presence has had the longest continuous and uninterrupted presence in the old city of Jerusalem, spanning 1,700 years.
1,700 years, yes. Since the first Armenians came, not long after the birth or the death of Christ, one you would say.
Yes. I mean, when
crucifixion, yeah?
When in 301 Armenia adopted Christianity as an official state religion, Armenian pilgrims began flocking to Jerusalem. So we've been here since the late Roman Empire, and we have outlasted the Byzantine Empire, the Mamluks, the Seljuks, the Ottomans, all the way to
the British,
time.
Even like
the British as well.
And here you are, and I cannot tell you what a privilege it is to be here. And is this the external wall as well?
Yes, right here.
Now, I now find myself standing beside barricades with what is the Armenian flags.
Yes, exactly.
Now, why in the old city of Jerusalem do you need barricades?
So basically, a property development company called Zana Gardens, through an illegal deal, and I say illegal because according to the bylaws of the Armenian Patriarchate of Jerusalem, any deal above 49 years are strictly forbidden. And this development company managed, via a corrupt priest, managed to get a 98-year lease.
What was this development company? Tell me a bit about it. Who owned it?
The majority shareholders, their names are Daniel Rubinstein or Daniel Rothman. He has a few aliases, as well as George Warwar. One is an Israeli-Australian businessman. The other is an Arab-Israeli Christian businessman.
And what do they want to do with this area?
They want to basically build a hotel on this land, and they basically want to take over the land, which is 11,500 square meters, and it represents 25% of the Armenian Quarter.
Of course, there have been a lot of these sort of deals, not just involving Armenians.
Yes, of course.
Not just your land, but the Greek Orthodox, the Catholic Church, I believe.
I mean, the whole of Christianity is under attack over here. And Christians should unite and stand as one to push back these attacks, whether it's via the taxations or encroachments. The Christian presence is fundamental to the cultural character of Jerusalem, and it should be maintained and protected.
Now, why have you got... You've got barbed wire?
Because since the 5th of November 2023, the first bulldozers illegally came over here and started tearing down our walls. As that happened...
Is that the rubble over there, which I can see?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So from the destruction, we took the materials and we barricaded the land to prevent further attacks or at least delay them.
And in front of me, I can now see a kind of temporary shelter. Is that what it was?
Yes, it's our headquarters, basically. And over here, for the past 700 days... we've been protecting and monitoring the land 24/7 at all times with cameras and with a well-organized communication system that we have put in place between the different community members.
And why do you need to be here 24 hours? They might come at any time?
Because we live in very uncertain times, so they can literally come at any time and attack us. So our presence is vital to safeguarding our heritage on this land and our presence.
The defenders of this area, do you get attacked?
Yeah, we got more than a dozen attacks. The biggest one happening on the 28th of December 2023, where about 20-30 armed thugs came here with electric chainsaws, with batons, with full aggression, trying to intimidate us, to kick us off our land. Obviously, the Armenian community united, galvanized by this external threat, and we stood firmly. Every attack they sent even reinforced our conviction in staying here and protecting our heritage.
And who pays for these thugs who come? And do you know who sends them?
We don't have an exact direct link, but one of the attacks, the District Court of Jerusalem pinned the blame on Zana Gardens. It's a property development company registered in Israel and the UAE. In my opinion, it's just a front to take over Armenian land.
And when you get attacked, presumably you just call the police, don't you?
Yes, normally in any democratic country, that's how it should work. You call the police, they break it off. But the police, even though the police station is 5 minutes away from here, they took a lot of time to respond. And when they came... they were very aggressive with us and even arrested some of our boys over here for merely defending their land.
And who, is it a Palestinian police station? Because we're in occupied East Jerusalem, or is it an Israeli police?
It's an Israeli police station, yeah. And it's literally 5 minutes away from here. So yeah. We haven't had the best relations with them since the past few years. They've been very rude, very aggressive, and... even though we're very peaceful and we always dialogue and communicate in order to reach a proper understanding, they have always been aggressive and reluctant to see both sides of the issue.
Mr. Netanyahu said just a few days ago that Israel was the great defender of Christianity. What do you say to that?
I don't think so. These are just words and they have no basis in reality, in my opinion. The Christian presence in Jerusalem is under attack. And if we don't stand united, we will lose the Christian presence in Jerusalem.
So you're on your own?
I mean, we've had help from ecumenical support from the different patriarchates, from Christian
activist groups. But not the
Israeli state.
Israeli activists have supported us, yes, and a lot of Israeli supporters have stood by us. But in as far as the state is concerned, nothing tangible.
Of course, you do get very brave Israeli activists. I've been in many of the villages, you know, where there are demonstrations of against the settlers stealing the land, and you will often find Israeli activists coming from Tel Aviv and elsewhere who are with the villagers.
Yes, yes, and even over here, when our priests go to processions to the Holy Sepulchre or different Christian sites, a group of activists with GoPro cameras, they monitor them in order to report hate crime attacks against them. And just last year, an astounding report came out that 50% of the hate crimes were targeting Armenians. It's a very strategic road over here. I mean, it's strategic in every way. It's the highest point on Mount Zion. Mm-hmm. It has biblical significance. It has economic potential. It has strategic potential. So it's coveted by many, this land. And Armenians have protected it against a lot of people. And they fought tooth and nail to preserve this land, this specific land, the Cow's Garden.
And the priests, when they're attacked, come where? Along the...
They exit the Armenian quarter through the convent gate. Yep. You can't miss it. It's right there. And they walk to the Holy Sepulchre through the Old City of Jerusalem.
And that's when they get attacked.
Yeah, they get spat on, harassed. Almost, it's a daily occurrence, almost.
Daily but,
yes,
occurrence.
Yes, yeah. But even the Armenian civils who are non-clergy, and you can't tell them apart usually by their attire, even we are attacked frequently. I mean, whether it's graffitis, whether it's pepper sprays, whether even a few years back, one of my friends almost got stabbed. So it's been a very difficult period for us over here. Very challenging. But again, as the difficulties approach, as the challenges increase, our resolve increases with it. So we're a united community. We know our rights and we know our heritage, our history. And they're simply not for sale. Our history and our presence is not for sale.
And who are these people who spit on you and attack you as you go to church?
More often than not, they're extremist Israelis. Extremist.
What does that mean, extremist?
Mostly religious extremist. Mm. Religious extremists. Sorry, and they. I mean, as soon as they walk past the convent gate, when they read Armenian writing or see a cross or something, they spit at the entrance of the Armenian quarter. So, again, it's a daily occurrence. If I put a camera at the entrance of the convent and monitor it for a year, I think we'll have more than 1,000 incidents reported.
And you say these attacks, they started in November 2023?
Yes.
And I think... there are two things one might associate it with. First of all, I think I'm right in saying that the Netanyahu government had come in.
I mean,
with its coalition with Ben-Gavir in charge of
nationalism. Yes, with extremist figures like that to embolden violence of this nature, it's exacerbated the situation over here. It's made it more difficult. But even before the arrival of this extremist government, it's always been an issue. So it's increased, evidently, but it's always been an issue.
So what is the building over there, which is that where the attack was made?
Or yes, here? As you can see, the debris over here, the damage, this is where the first bulldozer damaged the wall and began tearing it apart. As soon as that happened, again, the entire community gathered around here. We literally sat on these walls and stood in front of the bulldozers. The bulldozer went left, we went left with it. It went right with it. It tried to intimidate us to no avail. So,
this is where you were.
Yeah, basically.
All right, could we come in?
Yes, of course.
Welcome.
Feel free.
Thank you.
So these are our boys here. Hello. We each take turns monitoring and guarding the land. We've been here for the past 700 days, continuously, nonstop. We also have monitors to check out the perimeter to see if there are any attacks happening or any risk of attacks.
Yep.
We have a sophisticated communication system between us where we message each other in order to inform each other of an impending threat.
Yes. You were expecting anything tonight?
I don't think so, but in this region you never know.
Yes. When was the last attack?
A year ago.
Yeah. So it's not been recent.
No.
But it can come at any moment.
Yes. And the uncertainty is the most difficult part, honestly. Mm. Everything else we've managed to push back, but the uncertainty, not knowing when they're going to attack, that's the main issue.
How many Armenians are here at the moment in Jerusalem?
Give or take 2,000 Armenians.
Just 2,000?
Yes. So a clear minority.
And so this area here, which is under threat, what percentage of the Armenian presence in the old city?
The bulk of the Armenian presence is concentrated in the old city of Jerusalem, specifically in the Armenian St. James Armenian Monastery.
And so would they, if this land goes, how much is it? Is it a quarter?
This land is 11,500 square meters. It's 25% of the quarter. Yeah. If we lose it, it's only a matter of a generation or two before the Armenian presence disappears incrementally.
And what does that mean for Christianity?
I mean, it's a major blow. We're the first Christian nation. Just in the Armenian Patriarchate, after Yerevan, we hold the largest manuscript library in the world with countless priceless documents and historical documents that attest to our presence. And as I said before, we've had relations with different empires, different dynasties. We've had dialogue even with the Ottomans, who were responsible for the genocide of 1.5 million Armenians. Even with them, the Armenian Patriarchate had a diplomatic channel.
You go to Israeli ministers and say, look, our presence here in Jerusalem is being threatened, and we're being attacked, the police aren't helping us?
Yeah, we've approached a few, but there hasn't been a broad support. Some Israeli civil societies and activists, they join us, they support us, very vocally so, but on a state level, there hasn't been a tangible action from their part in order to save and protect.
The Netanyahu government has not lifted according to you, has just done nothing.
Nothing, no. Nothing at all.
Well, thank you very much for explaining the situation here.
My pleasure.
I do find it quite amazing to be sitting in a sort of outside a makeshift shelter in the old city of Jerusalem, surrounded by rubble and a barricade to protect one of the very oldest Christian communities in the world, and to learn that Christianity is under some kind of existential threat from the Israeli state. I don't think this is widely understood, and it's deeply shocking and a complete travesty of everything, even that Benjamin Netanyahu says, who claims that Israel is a great protector of Christianity.
Peter Oborne there, talking about the threat to Christianity, the country, the UK, being up for sale. Our foreign policy, you can come and buy it if you want. The shareholders can come and buy it and maybe do a hostile takeover. That's what was begun, of course, back in the Thatcher era by taking away all exchange controls, so allowing foreign money to come in willy-nilly and buy things up, and then privatisation, so it gave the foreign money something to buy, that is to say, our country. And it means, of course, that the voting means less and less and less all the time, as the more and more is privatised. So the Home Secretary, though, as part of Pax Judaica, has got no confidence in the West Midlands police, it seems. Maccabi Tel Aviv, even though they're racist thugs, and there are loads of examples of wherever they go, they like to do their dirty work, like the brown shirts of the Nazi era in the 1930s. They've got to be able to come here. So the government is defending the racist rioters the Israelis are sending here and trying to sack the chief constable who doesn't want them to do it. Anyway, it's a farce. Here's Sky News report on it.
Empty seats where Maccabi Tel Aviv fans should have been. Shut out from Aston Villa at the urging of West Midlands police. Protests on the night showing the scale of their challenge, even after pressure from leaders in Downing Street and Israel failed to overturn the ban. But more than 2 months since the Europa League match, the fallout and controversy from the decision continues. Initial findings from one of three reviews into the ban, critical of how it was decided and justified by officers. After receiving an 11-page letter from the Chief Inspector of Constabulary, who polices the police, the Home Secretary demanded change at the force.
The ultimate responsibility for the force's failure to discharge its duties on a matter of such national importance rests with the Chief Constable. And it is for that reason that I must declare today that the Chief Constable of West Midlands Police no longer has my confidence.
Good afternoon, Craig Guildford, Chief Constable of West Midlands Police.
Craig Guildford can't be fired by the government. Those powers were relinquished in 2011. Shabana Mahmood wants them back. But for now, she's relying on the Police and Crime Commissioner for the West Midlands, who says he'll wait to question Mr. Guildford in 2 weeks. The report into West Midlands Police is damning over inaccuracies and exaggerations. It's why the Home Secretary has concerns over their handling of sensitive information and the erosion of public confidence in the force. Twice Mr. Guildford has had to apologise for misleading MPs, for falsely claiming the Jewish community in Birmingham supported the ban, and this morning admitting a previous Maccabi match that never existed ended up in an intelligence report after being found using AI. There was a third apology tonight for the force for errors, without saying who they were apologising to. We are extremely sorry for the impact these have had on individuals and their communities. We are taking immediate action to address the matters raised in these preliminary findings. We know that mistakes were made, but reiterate the findings that none of this was done with an intent of deliberate distortion or discrimination. And Mr. Guildford still has backers, including the MP representing Aston.
Here we're in a situation where the Chief Constable's made a decision. I support that decision. The safety grounds aspect, I think it was the right decision, and I support the Chief Constable. I think most West Midlands police officers support the Chief Constable. And there's a learning curve, and they need to get to the drawing board to ensure that they don't make similar mistakes in the future.
Authorities in Birmingham were concerned about a repeat of the unrest around Maccabi's match in Amsterdam in 2024, when there were anti-Semitic attacks on Israelis and racist violence by visiting ultras. But inaccuracies interpreting evidence from Dutch officers are central to why West Midlands Police is accused of overstating the threat posed by Maccabi fans and understating the threat towards them. And it's left the Chief Constable fighting for his job. Rob Harris, Sky News, Westminster.
Well, I say a farce, but it's, of course, this is very sinister, isn't it? To have your, a foreign power with the ability to bully and sack your chief constable in the West Midlands for trying to stop football rioting. So there are some very wonderful Muslim people around. We had a couple of weeks ago on the emergency show I put together, I think it was the 3rd of January, we had Imran Khan speaking, brilliant speech at the United Nations. He's now in prison. Luckily, the Malaysian leadership are not. And at the latest United Nations General Assembly, a brilliant speech by the Malaysian. So all these people that go on about, oh, the Muslims, aren't they so terrible? Oh, this is the Israeli script you're reading in your brain. Because have a listen to the amazing statesman. This is the Foreign Minister of Malaysia.
I give the floor to His Excellency Mr. Mohammad Hassan, Minister of Foreign Affairs of Malaysia.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Madam President, Your Excellencies, may I begin by congratulating President Annalena Baerbock on being elected as the President of the 80th session of the General Assembly. I also wish to thank His Excellency Philemon Yang for his leadership throughout the 79th session of the General Assembly. Madam President, it is now the 80th session of the General Assembly. Yes, 80 years since our dreams of bright future gave birth to the United Nations. Humanity has imagined the future in many ways. Among other things, we imagined that in some of its darkest version, information overload would numb critical thought while apathy take over. I fear that this has come to pass. 8 years after the end of the Second World War, we are watching in high definition as genocide unfolds around the world. 8 years, after all, after the fall of the empires, colonialism is still alive, armed, funded, and justified by some of the supposedly most liberal powers in the world. They have defended and supported the only party who has any real power in a conflict as it makes a fuss out of international law. As we approach the 80th anniversary of the United Nations, Madam President, I suppose I should say congratulations. But today, that word rings hollow. Should we congratulate ourselves on our inability to bring an end to the occupation of Palestine? Or should we congratulate ourselves for allowing a rogue state to undermine our charter and our efforts? In Gaza, the clock is ticking, the bombs are falling, and the light is fading. We have failed at least 70,000 people. Israel can no longer hide behind its pretense of victimhood. From London to Dhaka, from Paris to Sydney, from Montreal to Kuala Lumpur, populations have spoken out in grief and outrage. More and more people are standing up for the truth that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. Remember, the eyes of the world are upon us. We must take action now, Madam President, now. Sanction Israel. The metastasis of Israel's brutality in Middle East cannot go on. Their latest assault on Doha was not merely an attack on a few representatives of Hamas. It was an attack conducted on another state's soil and an insult to the efforts of all who have attempted to mediate. And it is a signal that Israel's violence will continue to destabilize the region. The effect of this will spill over to the rest of the world. The atrocities may have begun with Palestine, but they certainly will not end with Palestine. As the Middle East grows ever more dangerous for its residents, we will feel the reverberations all over the world. And this is why simply advocating for a two-state solution is not enough, Madam President. Malaysia will agree to any measures of the support for the Palestinian people, including the New York Declaration. But let us be clear. Let us be clear, there are only three real answers to this conflict. Number one, to take concrete action against the occupying force. Two, to lend our long-term support to the development of a self-governing Palestinian state. And number three, to reform the United Nations and ensure that such a travesty of justice never happened again. Madam President, repeated failures of the Security Council to fulfill the will of the General Assembly must be met with strong resistance. We must continue to demand accountability from the permanent members of the United Nations Security Council through Resolution 76/272, or popularly known as the Veto Initiative. And we must pursue results through Resolution 377A, that is Uniting for Peace. No more shall we quietly accept the dismissal of our collective voice. We must question and challenge the veto. We must free the Security Council from this humiliating paralysis. And we must keep the United Nations a relevant and effective international organization and global guardian of peace. Madam President, over the course of our chairmanship of ASEAN this year, Malaysia too has learned of the colossal efforts that peace requires. As a unique example of an inclusive form of multilateralism, ASEAN has embraced change, expanded our membership, and engaged with the world over the past 58 years. And this is why it has been Malaysia's honor and our greatest task yet to take on Southeast Asia's challenge this year. When conflict threatened to spiral between our neighbors, ASEAN did not stand idle. We stepped in, convened both sides in Malaysia, and implemented a ceasefire, one that ASEAN is now ensuring takes root through active monitoring on the ground. Yes, challenges remain, but our message is clear. ASEAN will stay at the table, urging both states to honor their commitments, for there is no conflict, whether interstate or intrastate, that is worth risking the stability of our home. This is why our efforts to cultivate security and stability in Myanmar and to restore credibility to five-point consensus must continue. ASEAN is deeply disappointed that the agreed open ceasefires in Myanmar have been broken in some areas and that violence continues to endanger civilians. Those in power have a responsibility to remember that Myanmar is a part of region. It's a part of a region, not an isolated country. There is a bright and safe future for all of our peoples if we work together in good faith towards a Myanmar-owned, Myanmar-led resolution to the crisis in the country. Madam President, as ASEAN's focus deepens on bolstering security, strengthening economic resilience, and advancing sustainability goals across the region, we will address not only our internal crisis, but also from beyond. The South China Sea must not be used as leverage in strategic competition. Southeast Asia and its waters become a theater for rivalry between superpowers. We therefore urge all parties to fully comply with UNCLOS and to avoid actions that could provoke miscalculation or conflict in the waters we share. We will also continue to champion the rights and the needs of the global South at large. Madam President, for far too long, the global South has borne the brunt of unequal economic policies that marginalize and prevent developing nations from participating fairly in the global economy. And today, the global South faces a staggering financing gap for sustainable development, despite being home to the world's most vulnerable populations. The irony is painful, Madam President. We constitute the world's majority, yet remain unrepresented in decision-making, underserved in development financing, and sidelined in global governance. These imbalances must be corrected. The voices, needs, and aspirations of the Global South are not secondary. Remember this, we cannot build a fairer international order without the Global South at its center. Malaysia will continue to advocate for dignity, equity, and opportunity for all developing nations. Madam President, Excellencies, the UN has served the UN has served the world for 80 years, but the world we live is in shifting beyond any recognition from what it was back then. The task that we now face is an existential one, for the question of Palestinian has haunted the UN for nearly its entire life. 80 years of the United Nations and 77 years of the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians. I cannot emphasize this enough, Madam President. If we cannot resolve this, the citizens of the world will lose faith in us and the international order. Because there is no longer any way to deny that this is modern-day colonization. Only the formerly colonized have been able to see it for what it is since the start. It is a genocide dressed in the cape of Western tolerance. For us to remain relevant, we cannot move forward on the habits of the past. We must summon the same courage that built this organization from the ruins of war. To conclude, Madam President, Malaysia believes that three urgent reforms are key to our survival. First, we must limit, if not abolish, the veto. We must challenge it each and every time that is wielded, particularly in cases of crimes against humanity. Second, authority must flow back to the General Assembly and the most inclusive body. As the most inclusive body of this House, it should be allowed to serve as the conscience and voice of the world unimpeded. And third, we must redesign global financing mechanisms to ensure transparency and fairness for the Global South. Reform is no longer a choice. It is our imperative. Madam President, to be better together, we must change together. Billions of lives depend on whether we succeed. Madam President, I thank you.
I thank the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Malaysia.
That was the Foreign Minister of Malaysia addressing the United Nations General Assembly. So at least there's some good talking going on, even if it's not being reported. After the break, we'll be looking at reform and also the occult, with the real history of what's been going on and what's going to happen most likely. What are they planning, the stage managers of Armageddon?
My song shall be woven on the loving kindness of the Lord. With my mouth will I ever be sure in my truth from one generation to another. For I have said, mercy shall be set up forever. Thy truth shall thou stand.
Thank you. So that's Psalm 89, followed by the Freemasons' Love on My Mind. So welcome back to the Bristol Politics Show with me, Tony Gosling. No Martin and no Dave engineering this week. Dave's on holiday and he'll be back beginning of February along with Martin. Maybe have Martin in next week. But so straight from the Freemasons to the Freemasons.
More than 300 officers and staff in the Metropolitan Police have declared that they're Freemasons or members of a similar organisation. Britain's biggest force has required officers to reveal any such confidential membership since last month, a policy which is being challenged in the High Court by bodies representing Freemasonry. Here's our UK correspondent, Daniel Sanford.
It was the independent panel that looked into the unsolved murder of Daniel Morgan that recommended that London's main police force should require its staff to declare if they're Freemasons or members of other organisations with a hierarchical structure and confidential membership that might present a potential conflict of interest. Some officers involved in the original investigation of the axe murder of Daniel Morgan in 1987 were Freemasons, prompting never-proven suspicions of corruption linked to their membership. In December, the Metropolitan Police implemented the proposed policy, triggering a legal case brought by the United Grand Lodge of England and other Masonic groups. In a court order related to the case published this week, a judge revealed that more than 300 Met officers and staff have declared such a membership. The force confirmed today that the current number is 316 out of around 46,000 officers and staff. A spokeswoman said the vast majority of those declarations related to Freemasonry.
Isn't it good to see? Freemasonry is extremely dodgy. It's not just dodgy, it's a religious cult. If you want a religious cult running your country, fine. You know, this is the sort of thing that they accuse the Muslims of. But Freemasonry is the British version. The United Grand Lodge is largely nominally Christian, so they think they're Christians. But it's all based, the rituals are all based on witchcraft. And if you go back and have a look at the third degree Freemasonry, you have the use of a human skull. I don't know where they get their human skulls from. You also have a ritual murder. And of course, the idea is that you will be killed if you break the promises that you've made to the cult. So secrecy, etc. So there's no way that anyone in public life can possibly be a Freemason because you've already pledged your allegiance to the group and not to the public. So this is obvious to me that particularly within the police and the civil service, anything to do with public service, whether it's broadcasting or whatever, you cannot have Freemasons in there. And I would suggest the only way to do it is a simple law where you just say, if you're a Freemason, you cannot be in public office. And if you are found to be a Freemason whilst in public office, then you will be obviously sacked, but you will be prosecuted for malfeasance. That's misconduct in public office, which carries up to a life in prison. So that seems to be the only way to deal with the Masons. They seem to be a bit shilly-shallying here. And what happens if they are a Mason, but then they don't declare it? I mean, the lists are out there. Maybe the police should be down at Covent Garden investigating all the lists to see who's in this cult, because we don't want to be run by a cult. We want to live in a democracy, please. Speaking of which, a major incident's been declared in Kent as loads of people have got no water.
Around 25,000 people across southeast England are spending another day without water. Some of them have no idea when it's coming back either. The water companies are blaming the recent cold weather that caused burst pipes and power cuts. As a result, hospitals forced to hold virtual appointments, schools and businesses forced to close. For a lot of people, though, it's not the first time this has happened. Ofwat, the Water Services Regulation Authority, released a statement on X saying the following. Residents in Kent and Sussex are without water again. We're working with the lead regulator on this incident, the Drinking Water Inspectorate, and continuing our investigation to South East Water's supply resilience. Customers deserve reliable service. Well, residents of Tunbridge Wells have spoken to Sky about their frustrations. Let's take a listen.
We've got no water supply to our house and it's across the entire area. Schools have been affected, hospitals have been affected, business has been affected. It's been absolutely appalling. I live in Blackhurst Lane and at the end we have a reservoir. We have about four or five tankers every day piling up, and this has been for weeks and weeks, to load water into the reservoir. The pressure keeps dropping, the water's come through brown, a bit sludgy on occasions. Yesterday we had absolutely no water at all. I don't know how the elderly are coping with this in the slightest.
Let's bring in Olivia Guthrie, who's in Tunbridge Wells. And Olivia, how are people coping?
Well, I'm afraid I have bad news for those people, however they're coping. We have been told recently in the last few hours that South East Water has told local officials the boosters are to switch off again when the water level falls below the level where they can operate. This feels very reminiscent of the last time I was here in Tunbridge Wells when thousands were left without water for the best part of a week. This time South East Water are blaming, as you say, Storm Goretti and cold weather for bursting pipes and cutting power. They've apologised and say they are working round the clock to fix the situation. They're also handing out bottled water to residents who don't have any supply. That here at Tunbridge Wells Rugby Club, they ran out of water yesterday and so they had to close early, meaning that lots of people did not get any supplies. But they have now restocked, and some of the 25,000 residents who are currently without water are now queuing up to receive their supplies. And some of them are now calling for the army to take over and deal with this situation. The local MP, Mike Martin, telling me it's astonishing that we continue to leap from water crisis to water crisis without an inch of accountability. It's obvious that South East Water's CEO must resign and its chair and shareholders must urgently move to get fresh leadership in from outside the organisation. And the regulator have launched an investigation into South East Water, and Sky News understands that MPs are meeting today to decide whether to recall Chief Executive David Hinton, who was accused of misleading them when he was questioned over exactly why South East Water raised bills 20% last April, but residents don't appear to be getting any better service from them.
So it's Thatcher, isn't it? And it's the idea that the shareholders are much more important than the actual people that need to drink water. So I shouldn't laugh, really. And the SPIVs running these things. So they could have easily, very, very easily, have renationalised it. But no, Starmer doesn't want to do that. He's made promises to the World Economic Forum. And so it's obviously the thing to do, but they won't. So this is hollowing out the nation. And because of all the horrible politics, and I'm not saying Reform are any better, but they are in a position where, with a bit of non-AI scripted political speech, they can do quite a lot. And we've had Leila Cunningham and also Robert Jenrick doing that this week. So let's first start by having a listen to how she thinks she can reshape London. I mean, it does sound to me as if, that looking at the polls too, as if Reform are just going to walk in many of these places and they're going to do extremely well in May.
London! Finally! Finally, London has hope. And that hope comes down to all of you. We announced this week that I'm standing to be the next mayor of London, but that election is 2.5 years away. The first battle for the future of London starts today, but it is won on May 7th. These local elections are not a sideshow. They're not low stakes. They're not irrelevant. They are the first referendum on Sadiq Khan's London. And we have to make everyone know that his time is up. And to all of you, every Labour councillor who gets elected in May is a vote to keep this disaster going. Every councillor who stays in place is another propping him up while London burns. May 7th is London's chance to begin taking this city back, and that's why every single person in this room matters. I've got to put it to you, not here to just clap. We expect you to stand, to campaign, to knock on doors, to deliver leaflets, and especially to run as candidates, to become the political shockwave that this city has not felt in decades. It is up to us, ladies and gentlemen, because London finally has something it hasn't had
for a very long time. A real alternative and hope. Because finally, reform has landed in London. London doesn't belong to Labour. It doesn't belong to the Tories. It belongs to the people. And that's why you're all here, because the fight to win back London, a London that works for Londoners, not just politicians, not just Labour politicians, but one that works for all of us. Because I can assure you that reform, we're not here to defend failure. We're not here to defend the status quo. No, we're here to change it, because the status quo doesn't suit the people. A party that stands for the people who live here, not the political class that ruined it. So from now until May 7th, I will be in every borough. I've already been seen a few of you. Every corner of the city, building the force that defeats Khan's machine. Council by council, ward by ward, person by person. I can't do it alone. I want you all with me. London is my home. It really made me who I am. I was born here. I discovered my basketball skills here, and I perfected them here. I played in the London Youth Games. I became a senior Crown prosecuting here, and I'm raising my 7 children here, and that is 7 reasons why this fight matters to me more than any election ever could. And I know all of you are here fighting for your family and your children. I love this city, and I know you all love it just as much as me, but I'm not blind to what it's become. London, one of the greatest cities on earth, probably the greatest city, is no longer safe. And that didn't happen by accident. That happened by a betrayal, by neglect. That happened on Sadiq Khan's watch. Let's just go through some of the stats. Knife crime, up by 68% during his 10 years. Robbery, 50%, more than 100,000 phones stolen every year. Ladies and gentlemen, we are also living in a rape epidemic. And for me, crime is an abstract. You all know the story of how my children were targeted by masked men. Day after day, we were terrified. And in a civilized society, in a proper country with proper leadership, I could have relied on the police. But no, I was told there weren't enough resources. Not enough resources. So I had to gather the evidence myself. I had a baby, I put him on the baby carrier, I followed the gangs, I took photos. I protected my children when the state couldn't, and I know a lot of you would do the same. But none of us should ever have to be in that position. I shouldn't have had to be in that position. There should have been police, but most of all, there should have been leadership. There should have been a mayor that cares. But we all know there isn't. I speak to so many women who don't feel safe. In fact, I went to Zara the other day, and the manager there comes up to me and she whispers and she goes, you know, are you Layla? She goes, you know, I'm the manager. I go, why are you whispering? She goes, oh, you know, because I can't tell them I'm supporting reform. But she says, I've never voted before, but I'm going to vote for you 100%, because she was on a bus and she was being touched up by a foreign man. She didn't want to tell me where he was from. She got to the end of the bus stop. The police were there. They arrested him. Oh, she had a sigh of relief. She got on the bus. The next day, he was sat next to her again. Another time, it happened to her again. And she was met at the end of the bus stop by her husband and the police officer. Sorry, it was her boyfriend. And the boyfriend told the man, you touch my girl again, you rat, and I'm going to show you what's coming. You know what happened? The police said, if you talk to him again, we're going to have to arrest you for racial abuse. Exactly that. She said another time, and this is true, she was mugged for her phone at knife point. The youth was arrested. It was a youth. He had 5 phones on him. The police rang her and said, you know what, we had to let him go, madam, because he's a youth. This is what's happening on our streets. Parents panic when their children don't answer the phone. I panic when my son's out. Has he got into a fight? Has someone pulled a knife? And I see masked gangs roam our streets like no one is in charge and no one's going to stop them. And you know what? No one will. The social contract between us and the state has collapsed. You know why? Because the state has failed in its first duty.
And that duty is to keep us safe. You can't have private police. Police and safety is the one thing that we rely solely on the government for. You have enough money, if you're lucky enough, you can go privately to a school. You can go privately to a doctor. You cannot have your own private police force. And when people say that Khan doesn't listen, that's an understatement. He attacks. He smears. He calls us racist for saying London isn't dangerous. He says we're lying because we're all Islamophobic, because he's Muslim. That's what it all comes down to for him. Identity politics. And that's an insult to victims. It's an insult to my kids. It's an insult to you. And it's an insult to Londoners. You know what it is? It's a coward's excuse for failure. Londoners are scared because London is more dangerous. Three boy men were just stabbed on Edgware Road this week. You know what? We read it and we're like, oh, yeah? We've become accustomed to it. That's not normal. And he still tells us, my fight against crime is working. Shall we recap his so-called fight against crime? Visible policing, basically non-existent. Any of you see a police when you walk down the street? Stop and search, halved, even though we know, and he knows that stop and search prevents knife crime. But again, he politicized it. He boiled it down to identity politics. And what does he do? What does he do in the face of all rising violent crime? He diverts officers into policing tweets, mums and pups at home instead of the streets. This, ladies and gentlemen, is how criminals took control of our great city. And here's the truth, by the way. He's not a bystander. He is responsible. He is the police and crime commissioner. He appoints the Met commissioner. He sets the priorities. He signs off the budget. The chaos, the danger is because of him. So I'll tell you this, London. If I'm mayor, there will be visible policing. There will be a zero tolerance approach. Because even if you shoplift a £20 piece of steak, that's corrosive to the community. There will be consequences. You know what there'll be? There'll be a new sheriff in town. Yay! And I will launch, I can assure you, an all-out war on crime against knife gangs, drug dealers, phone thieves, shoplifters. And those rape gangs that have been ignored, I can assure you, they will have nowhere to hide. It will be a reckoning. Every single person who let those girls down, there will be a reckoning for them. There will be nowhere for them to hide. See, London isn't just another city, is it? It is the capital of the United Kingdom. It should be a place of pride, of confidence, of belonging. A place where our British flag is seen everywhere as a symbol of everything we share. Our history, our freedoms, our law, our greatness. When that flag flies all over London, it tells anyone that comes here that this country is worth standing up for. And Londoners have had enough of being divided. Pitted against each other. Because in reform, it doesn't matter who you pray to or who you love, your sexual preference. If you believe in this country, if you stand up for Britain, then you are a Londoner that we all stand with. That shared pride is what will bring this city back together, united, and make London strong again. And this fight doesn't begin, by the way, in 2.5 years. It begins on May 7th. That is when we break Labour's grip on this city. Every person standing here, every Reform councillor elected, is a message to Labour and City Hall, Your time is up. Every reform volunteer is another door knocked. Every candidate is another crack in the machine. Every leafleting round is another family hearing the truth, is another family with hope. This is how we beat them, not waiting. If you are here tonight, I know you care about this city. Please, put yourself forward. Stand for your ward. Be the person who refuses to let London go, who refuses to let our city be dominated by those that don't care about us, that don't prioritise us. But I'll tell you this, winning back London doesn't start with me. It starts when people finally say, we will not be governed by politicians who are only in it for themselves. We want a London that works for Londoners, not politicians. He knew that the ULEZ expansion would target the very poorest. He knew. He just didn't care because it worked for him. I want the freedom that safety brings. The freedom to walk home and not be worried that you're going to be mugged. The freedom to let my children go out and not have to call them incessantly and track them on their phone. The freedom to build a future in London without fear. And let's face it. This dream for a safe, secure, united London wouldn't be possible without Nigel. Because for the first time in a generation, Britain has a leader who actually believes in this country, who believes in its people, and a leader that speaks for us, not at us. He didn't build this movement for Westminster. He built it to give the people, to give you your voice back. And that voice is coming to London. Yeah. On May 7th, we take the first step. We take it together. We break London's grip. We send a message that this city doesn't belong to anyone but the people. And from there, we march, flag in hand, all the way to City Hall. So on May 7th, please, do everything you can so people can have a safe London, a proud London, a London that works. Vote reform, stand for reform, and let's take London back. Thank you.
So that's a quarter of an hour of Leila Cunningham, who's just been announced as the Reform UK candidate for the Mayor of London. And, you know, a lot of what she's saying there, people in London will just think, yes, this is what's happening. And it's nothing to do. It's a shame because, people like Sadiq Khan, if he's favouring Muslims, which it certainly seems to be, he's not doing Muslims any favours either, is he? I think there's an almost horrific amount of weaponization of these political positions. I'm not saying these people are Masons, but who knows? Their loyalty is not to the public. That's pretty obvious. But we had a big announcement, didn't we, Thursday, where Robert Jenrick, who's the number one candidate to take over the Tory party, has decided he's not interested in the Tory party anymore. And here is Nigel Farage saying there is definitely no plot. He's not going to come on the airwaves at 4:30 today to announce he's now Reform UK. But of course he did. So here's Farage, and also we've got Kemi Badenoch and Robert Jenrick himself.
Kemi Badenoch sacked Robert Jenrick from her shadow cabinet this morning and explained why in a video she posted on social media.
I was very sorry to be presented with clear, irrefutable evidence, not just that he was preparing to defect, but he was planning to do so in the most damaging way possible to the Conservative Party and his shadow cabinet colleagues. It is my responsibility to protect our party. And faced with that information, I took the only decision that any responsible leader could.
She went on to say, the British public are tired of political psychodrama, and so am I. They saw too much of it in the last government. They're seeing too much of it in this government. Nigel Farage happened to be giving a press conference today alongside his new Reform UK party leader in Scotland. That's the former Conservative Lord Offord. Mr Farage was asked whether Robert Jenrick was planning to defect and said, of course he's had conversations with him, but nothing was signed.
And she's panicked, and she clearly thought at 4:30 this afternoon Robert Jenrick was going to join Reform UK.
Is there a plot, Mr. Farage?
He was not going to join. There was no plot for him to join at 4:30 this afternoon. There's no plot. There are many, many private conversations happening between myself, senior Conservative figures at all levels around this country.
Well, just 3 weeks ago, Robert Jenrick was on Times Radio and he was asked about a possible defection to Reform UK.
Well, it wasn't very long ago that I was running to be leader of the Conservative Party, so I'm not going anywhere.
Also speaking at the World at One Thursday, was Nadine Dorries. She had some interesting analysis of what's gone wrong with the Conservative Party.
The Reform Party is a natural place for those Conservatives who, in their thoughts, embody true Conservative principles to go to. And, you know, people at the top of the Reform Party, Zia Yousaf, Leila Cunningham, who's just been announced as their candidate for London Mayor, are all former Conservatives. But I would caveat that by saying, I know there are a very small number of Conservative MPs or former MPs that Nigel Farage would accept into the Reform Party, because so many Conservative MPs really, you could class as Liberal Democrats today. So there are very few of them who would actually be welcome. I don't know this, but I believe that Robert Jenrick would be one of them. But I couldn't say that because I don't know. I think people like Neil O'Brien, maybe. There are those few who are left on the right of the Conservative Party.
Jacob Rees-Mogg, who I'm about to speak to.
Jacob. Well, no. You know, not Jacob. Jacob will...
What's wrong with Jacob?
Because I think Jacob and I both come from the same place. We just see different ways of achieving it. Jacob will come solidly from the position of wanting to unify those on the right of the Conservative Party and Reform at a general election. I think Jacob's waiting for that day.
Well, I want to ask you about that, because there were some people who just look at the stats and would say there is no way Reform on its own, or even the Conservatives on its own, could win. They have to do a deal. Would you be prepared
to... I would say anybody who's saying that is being very presumptuous. You know, we have local elections in May. Nigel Farage has yet to hit the campaign trail. We know what a formidable campaigner he is. I would suggest humbly that when those local elections start to take place, you will see a considerable increase in the poll rating of Reform.
So that's Nadine Dorries. But what about Robert Jenrick himself? The interesting thing about him, this is 20 minutes, but he's got a lot of insight into the way government's actually been operating behind the scenes. So he's now likely to become a shadow chancellor. And if Reform win the next general election, the Chancellor of the Exchequer. So maybe he's done the right thing, maybe he's done the wrong thing. But anyway, it's very interesting to hear what he's got to say about his former party, the Conservatives, and how they did government, and also how they did, how Badenoch ran the shadow cabinet.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Nigel. It's time for the truth. Britain has been in decline. Britain is in decline. From 1970 to 2007, real wages went down by one third every 10 years. Since then, they flatlined. At the turn of the millennium, the average Brit was earning more than twice as much as the average Pole. By 2031, we're on track to be poorer. Outside of London and the South East, our economy is closer to Bulgaria's than to Germany's. Today, 18 to 30-year-olds are the first Britons to earn less than their parents. Houses cost more here than in any other OECD country. We have the highest energy prices in the developed world. Our heavy industry has more than halved since 2003. Our service sector is exposed to AI. One in five working Brits are now not working at all. Our debt is the highest it's been since the 60s. Our tax burden, the highest since the 50s. We're spending more on debt interest than on defence and schools combined. In 2012, One in 20 people who went to A&E waited more than 4 hours. Now it's 8 times that. One in 5 school kids are persistently absent. 93% of crime goes unresolved. The courts are backlogged. The prisons are overflowing. Our army is the small it's been since Napoleonic times. 193,000 people have come here on small boats since 2018. Last year, one illegal migrant raped a 12-year-old girl in Nuneaton. Terrorists have broken into Britain on small boats. And we're living through the most profound change to our population in our nation's history. Net migration is 100 times higher. In the 25 years after 1997, than in the 25 years before it. 1 in 5 in Britain weren't born here. Many are not working or are doing low-paid work. Just 1 in 20 of 2022's migrants were net contributors. Countless communities in less than 25 years have become totally unrecognisable. The police, as we've seen this week, can't even police some of our largest cities. Now, my constituents in Newark feel this decline every day. It's a great historic town. It is the honour of my life to represent it and to represent them in Parliament. They are the best of our country. They are men and women who are getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning, 7 a.m., out the door, to work in distribution centres and factories, grafting all week, but finding nothing left over for something nice with the kids on the weekends. Their bills, their taxes are surging. Their money is taken to fund hotels for those here illegally in our country, or the lifestyle of the guy down the road, who everyone knows could be working, but isn't working. I challenge anyone to argue other than that Britain is completely broken. Those that came before us built a great country, the greatest country in the world, but we are set to lose it. We will, for certain, if this government gets re-elected. A suicidal energy policy, crushing workers to fund scroungers on benefits, unions running our public services, payouts to terrorists, prosecutions of veterans, the bravest of the brave, 900,000 migrants in their first year, 65,000 of them illegally, ending jury trials, cancelling elections, giving away our territory, and 35 billion quid for the privilege. These people run Britain as if they hate it. But whilst this government is accelerating our decline, they didn't begin it. We've had 20 to 30 years of this. And why has it happened? Because the two main parties are rotten. They are no longer fit for purpose. They both broke Britain, and neither can fix it. It's a conclusion about the Conservative Party that has pained me to reach, because I've been a member of this party since I was 16 years old. I've served it for most of my adult life. I have countless good friends in the party, not least my own members in Newark. They are the most decent, patriotic people I know. And I respect, I cherish the party's contribution to our country, the party of Pitt and Peel, of Churchill and Thatcher. But our country is in a precarious, dangerous position. And my first loyalty, our first loyalty, must be to our country. Turning it around will require each and every one of us to speak the truth. And not just to speak it, but to act. What's the truth? Both Labour and the Conservatives broke Britain. and both are now dominated by those without the competence or the backbone needed to fix it. Both parties, if judged by their own actions, are committed to a set of ideas that have failed and are failing Britain. Labour started mass migration, but the Conservatives ramped it up. After 2019, the Conservatives almost left us without a border. 5 million came, three quarters not to work. When I was Minister for Immigration in late 2022, I fought colossal fights for reductions in legal migration alongside Suella Braverman. There were 23 people in Cabinet back then. Just one or two others were with us. Most of the party, ultimately, wanted what they viewed as cheap labour. And it's the same on illegal migration. Blair enshrined the ECHR into British law. He put the so-called human rights of illegal migrants, of terrorists, of criminals, above our national security. But so did the last Conservative government. I will never forget, never forget, attending a cabinet meeting in Downing Street where a plan to stop the boats was signed off. But everyone, to a man and a woman round that table, knew in their hearts it was not going to work. Some even joked about it. I left Downing Street that night, resolved to resign from the cabinet. And I've never forgotten that. And it isn't just immigration. Let me be very clear. In 2008, Miliband legislated that we put major cuts to our emissions above having cheap and reliable energy in our country. For the poorest, for our heavy industry, for each and every business in our land. What did the Conservative Party do? It didn't just keep and execute his plan. It doubled down on it with insane net zero targets. And now, Ed Miliband is back, and he's gladly picked it up again. Immediately after the last election, I said, I think more than anybody else in the Conservative Party, the truth about the last Conservative government. The day after the general election, I said the Conservative Party had failed in government, that there was hardly a principle they didn't betray. Hard taxes? They were left at a 70-year high. Sound money? Well, the debt tripled. Defence? Utterly hollowed out. Work should pay? Welfare exploded. Law and order? Prisons overflowed. In betraying its principles, the Conservative Party betrayed its voters, its members, and the men and women who elect me in Newark and Nottinghamshire. And let's be very clear with ourselves. This didn't just happen. It wasn't bad luck. It's because over time, most of the party in Westminster lost its way. The principles were betrayed because a critical mass don't believe in those principles at all. After the last election, I hoped, like others, that the Conservative Party would change, reckon with our mistakes, with humility, that it would repent. I said this after the election, and I fought for it. I fought for it every day. That's why I stood to be leader of the Conservative Party. That's why I picked myself up the day after I lost the leadership of the Conservative Party and kept fighting, because I hoped that it would be possible. But over the last year, I've realised that I was naive. It hasn't happened. Most of the Conservative Party in Westminster are in denial. Or worse, they're being dishonest about what the party's done. At a recent shadow cabinet debate, a conversation broke out. The question was put to the group, is Britain broken? I said instinctively, it's broken. Almost everyone said, it's not broken. And we were told, That is the party line. A few had a third position. It is broken, but we can't say so, because the Conservative Party broke it. If they won't admit publicly to you, the British people, what they broke, what possible faith can you have in them to fix it? The Conservative Party in Westminster isn't sorry. It doesn't get it. It hasn't changed. It won't change. It can't change. Now, the people I'm about to mention are all decent people. But because I'm here today, I need to explain myself. I owe that to you, the public, and to the people who elect me. Look at the top table. The Shadow Chancellor, Mel Stride, has rightly attacked Labour for hiking taxes to fund more scrounging. But there's just one problem. He was the Cabinet Minister who oversaw the explosion of the welfare bill. And it was him who blocked the reforms that are needed. Priti Patel, the Shadow Foreign Secretary, created the very migration system that enabled 5 million migrants to come here. The greatest failure of any British government in the post-war period. When asked about this last year, she defended her actions. She doesn't believe she did anything wrong. Now look, I respect Kemi, but I don't trust the Conservative Party on immigration. Just two current Conservative MPs voted with me against the fraudulent plan to stop the boats. Two out of all the Conservative Party. Last year, I said the rape gang disgrace was in part because people with medieval attitudes towards women and girls had been allowed into our country. Would you believe it? Several Conservative MPs complained about me for speaking out. They said I was wrong, and I shouldn't be saying that about the record of the last Conservative government. Over Christmas, I instinctively saw the news that the anti-British, anti-Semitic terrorist sympathiser, El Fatah, coming here to live in our country and enjoy the generosity of our people was wrong, and I spoke out against it. Let me tell you, several figures in the Conservative Party were angry at me. They said, and I quote, "It exposed the party to criticism for having granted him citizenship in 2021. The fact is the Conservative Party is so compromised that it cannot speak for the country. It cannot oppose Labour's madness. It is not fit for purpose. So yes, I'm glad Kemi has made getting rid of the rule of European judges Conservative Party policy. But I know better than anybody else, from the leadership campaign, at least two-thirds of Conservative MPs oppose this. They told me that. Privately, some of them said so publicly. There have been no Damascene conversions. There's not a traffic jam on the road to Damascus. Over the last few weeks, in meetings and in calls, I told Kemi and her team what I've told you all today. The Conservative Party needed to change fundamentally, starting by acknowledging the state of Britain and owning up to the role we played in getting Britain to this point. I respect Kemi, but on all those issues, we were in different places. Let me be clear. They've doubled down. I can't kid myself anymore. The party hasn't changed, and it won't. The bulk of the party don't get it. They don't have the stomach for the radical change that Britain needs. In opposition, it's easy to paper over these cracks, but the divisions, the delusions are still there. And if we don't get the next government right, Britain will likely slip beyond the point of repair. Everything is on this. Everything is on this decision. I can't, in good conscience, stick with a party that's failed so badly, that isn't sorry, that hasn't changed, that I know in my heart won't, can't deliver what's needed. That is why I resolved to leave. Because Nigel has stood consistently and very often alone for what's needed. Ending mass migration, for cheap energy, for cutting waste and taxes and red tape. Now, I don't agree with everything that he's ever said. And he definitely won't have agreed with everything that I've ever said. But in retrospect, I see that in this period, when two main parties were failing Britain, Nigel was all too often a lone voice of common sense. When the first boat started crossing, who was in the channel saying that it was outrageous? They laughed at him. Well, they're not laughing now. Nigel has stood for the real change that we need now as a country for over a decade, frankly, for most of my adult lifetime. If anyone puts party allegiance, personal ambition, to one side, he is obviously, obviously, the right person to lead the movement for change Britain needs. Recognising the situation our country is in, I reached out to Nigel in September. I could see then the Conservative Party wasn't changing, couldn't fix Britain. I didn't know that I was going to defect. In fact, we didn't discuss that. I just knew the responsible thing to do, the honest thing to do for me, was to explore all options. From the conversations that we've had since, quietly, and from what I've seen Nigel and Richard and Zia and Lee and Danny and Sarah say and do publicly, I am convinced that Nigel and Reform will deliver the real change we need. Nigel knows, Reform knows, the extraordinary challenges that Britain faces require a comprehensive plan to turn our country around. That'll be a major priority for this year. As Nigel has said, we will set out to build and recruit the team needed to execute that plan. Yes, a few people will come from parties who have realised that those parties have lost their way, who unquestionably back the real change the Reform will bring. But far more importantly, people will come from outside of politics, people who've done great things in business, in our schools, in our hospitals, our prisons, our armed forces, people the two political parties have locked out and ignored for far too long. For all those reasons, today I am proud to join the more than 270,000 people who are members of Reform UK, to back Nigel, to join this incredible movement, a national movement that will pool Britain's talents, experience and expertise, put previous differences to one side and deliver the real change we need. Turn our country around. At this hour, with Britain on the brink, in real danger, this is what we must do. If you agree with us, don't sit on the sidelines. Britain is broken. Britain needs reform. And reform needs you. Thank you all very much indeed.
So that's Robert Jenrick. Interesting guy. He's now with Reform. And I just wish that we could see similar sorts of powerful speeches from the other parties, your party, the other insurgent parties, even from George Galloway's party. But they're both really, really badly run by their general secretaries. And I mean, I know happen to know quite a lot about Galloway's party, having been an ex-member. And Paul Cannon, the General Secretary, and Tim Pendry, who was one of his assistants, are just appalling people. I was pointing out, look, you're circulating far-right stuff. And rather than say, thanks very much for pointing it out, Tony, no, they banned me from everything. And then when I put in a complaint, this guy, Hoz, I don't really sure who he is, didn't even investigate my complaint at all. So they're not a serious party, and people can complain and say, oh, it's the press, they give Reform so much. No, it's not just the press. It's also that the people actually running the party from behind the scenes, the apparatchiks, you call them, in your party and the Workers' Party, are possibly even agents. I mean, they certainly don't seem to be working for Galloway or Corbyn. Who are they working for? And MI5, of course, have had a many years, decades, interest in the left. They take a much more interest in that than they do in the right. Or maybe the right are just better at spotting the agents. So that's Reform, and they're probably set to do even better in the polls with some of these defections. But we're going to wind up this week with was for me a fascinating look at the occult, which is looking at the past and the future in this Orwellian fashion. He who controls the present controls the past, and controls the past controls the future, something like that. Anyway, I quote it properly in the full length version of this. But we're going to hear quite a long chat with Matthew Errett and David Livingstone, both from Montreal. Talking about the kind of stage managers for Armageddon. So that's who these people are, where they've come from, and where they're trying to drag us.
The world was divided empires, right? You get somebody becomes a charismatic leader, leads, gathers his people, becomes enormously powerful, and conquers various nations and absorbs them into one single empire. And that empire is usually guided by some kind of an ideology so that multiple nations could be members of it, right? So like the Roman Empire was composed of all kinds of nationalities and religions, as was the Persian Empire, the Muslim Empire. What you have novel in the idea of nations is that nations now are based on the some kind of artificial fabricated identity, which is usually tied to something very superficial, like sometimes religion, but usually ethnic identity, a language, and things like that. And what's also very important is that the architects of this new nationalism were mostly German philosophers associated with the Illuminati, like Herder and Fichte, who were also disciples, again, of Moses Mendelssohn, who was purportedly a successor of Shabtai Zvi, founder of modern Judaism through the Haskalah, which out of which comes the Zionist movement. So it all comes back together. So it seems like this, Sridhar Westphalia laid the groundwork for this sort of emerging division of the world into this mosaic of patchwork of states. So that 1948 the first thing that happened is that the United Nations was created, and then the United Nations, which was given the authority and power to sanction the creation of the State of Israel. And if you look at what Theodore of David Ben-Gurion himself stated, he admits that he envisions a world where you will have a sort of a United Nations being a sort of serving as a global empire seated in Jerusalem with his headquarters in fulfilling Bible prophecy. And those are his words. So if we look at where we're going, that's where we're going. This ultimately is the real goal that we're headed to. Transhumanism and all these sort of side, the artificial intelligence are just part of the mechanisms and tools towards that end goal. Tony, it all comes back to accelerationism. It's all about accelerating the coming of the end times, and that's why these things are all interconnected. So, you know, to make a long story short, the whole idea of transhumanism is based, and this is not my hypothesis, this is an AI, this is Nick Bostrom, who's one of the founders of the transhumanist movement. He wrote a book called The History of Transhumanism, and he traces it back to the legend of the Golem. He traces also like the alchemy and these other things, and to the Frankenstein legend, because the Frankenstein legend itself is based on alchemy. But it's this idea that comes back to the creation of an artificial being through Kabbalistic magic. And the person to articulate this in modern times was Norbert Wiener, who was one of the founders of the cybernetics movement, which is a CIA-backed movement to produce the personal computer and the beginnings of artificial intelligence. And he explained that if what makes God God is the ability to create life. So if humans are able to create intelligence, effectively creating life, that makes them God. And this is the mission that Norbert Wiener prescribed. And so this is effectively became the goal of a project, long-term project, largely backed by the CIA to ultimately create artificial intelligence. And we've seen how this has manifested recently. It's ultimately its goal. I can, you know, I'm not going to provide all the evidence to support my claim, but these are not my words. Their goal is to create, as was made evident with the Total Information Awareness Program of DARPA, is to create the all-seeing eye. So artificial AI is a goal to create sort of a god, a digital god, who will be able to be omniscient. And to, and from what I'm gathering for put things that people like Musk are saying to you, basically, if it overlaps with the whole idea of technocracy, this being, this artificial intelligence will actually be able to even, by feeding off of the entire collective of data of not only all of humanity today, but the collective of the accumulated human knowledge, it will be able to govern humanity. And that, I think, basically is the goal. So you combine this of, you know, a New World Order headquartered in Jerusalem as fulfilled Bible prophecy and the coming of an Antichrist / supposed Messiah. Somehow the goal of artificial intelligence is one and the same, because it seems that their goal is to create this, a grandmaster AI as some kind of to have it worshipped as a being. It basically similar to me of the idea of the beast in the book of Revelation.
Yeah, so Elon Musk's grandfather, Joshua Haldeman, he had this. It's good to be talking to Canadians about this, because the Canadian technocracy movement was something in the 1930s and the 40s. So this was also considered to be a little bit too pro-Nazi, because it had these eugenics aspects. And a lot of these people went down to South Africa. But anyway, be great to hear, Matt, from you what you make of all of this technology. I mean, when I was a child, there was a BBC series called The Changes, which was particularly gripping because it was all about it was a TV kids drama, which they would never allow today, I don't think, because it was a little bit too shocking, where you find that the whole population in England anyway turns against all technology, and they start going around smashing up everything, which is like an electric light bulb comes in, people go weird, and then they start to smash it up. A radio is thrown across the street, people are in the street smashing up cars, this sort of thing. And but anyway, there was obviously some sort of feeling at the time creatively that maybe technology was getting out of control. Now, listen, I mean, that was 1975, so we're talking about 50 years on. It's way out of control. Technology is now creating these artificial images of children, which the British government is grappling with. They're not sure what to do about. We've also got, of course, Palantir and their artificial wars, where their software is being used to target families, kids, etc., all automatically. And you know, the army leader can just switch off the command structure and switch on the computers, who can then go and target and kill for themselves. So what do you make of this, where we are at now with this and the actual objectives?
I guess I was just still chewing on David's contribution, most of which I agree with. A few items I would provide a different hypothesis, which I'll try to speak to, and I'll address your question at the same time. In regards to, Palantir, well, one thing that flows off of what David was talking about with the Total Information Awareness Program, that John Poindexter, who was a high-level Straussy neocon that went to jail for his role in setting up a shadow parallel government during Iran-Contra. He went to jail working with Ollie North, but then he got promoted when the Wolfowitz network came back into play. And he was assigned to set up the Total Information Awareness. And as David pointed out, the Eye of Horus was the selected symbol used to convey, to sell this new thing, to protect American citizens from, scary, dangers like terrorism and everything else, and also protect Americans from their own thoughts, frankly, because thoughts lead to action, and action leads to terrorism, right? So anyway, that didn't go over so well at the time in 2003, and it's interesting that the same CIA operation that Poindexter interfaced with, called the InQtel, was what provided in 2004, the year after, or just even months after Total Information Awareness, is put down, Palantir is created, and it's InQtel, the CIA venture capital branch that's funding Palantir, to basically do all the same thing that Total Information Awareness was promising to do, except now under a new civilian cardboard cutout. And of course, Palantir itself is a reference to the Lord of the Rings or the all-seeing eye, that if whoever holds and looks into the Palantir can see, is basically omniscient and can see everything. So I think part of this notion that is part of the big myth of global control, is this idea of the panopticon, you know, that we are the slaves will not want to rebel to the degree that they feel like the gods are watching their every move and watching their every thought. And so that creates a bit of that Orwellian stop think, right? Before you have the dangerous thought, you don't even have the thought because you predictively kind of know. It's this protective stupidity thing where you know that you're going to get zapped by the invisible electric offense if your mind goes to certain places that it's not supposed to go. So it's nice self-policing. It works quite well. And I think at the top, those cyberneticist high priests who are pushing this transhumanist program religiously kind of know it's a magic trick, but they know that what they want is the effect of people complying to the imagined threat of what will happen to you if you don't. On the issue of Elon Musk's grandfather and Technocracy Inc. and his role in Canada pushing this new reset of humanity, he's directly tied to some high level occultists, including A.R. Oraj, who heads up the New Age magazine, a high level theosophist who coined the term social credit, which, you know, Joshua Haldeman ends up running the social credit party after his work with Technocracy Inc. doesn't go anywhere because he gets arrested for being a fascist in World War II. So, you know, you've got these high level occultists. They're publishing Crowley's works in Oraj's New Age magazine. That's what Major C.H. Douglas, a British, again, military intelligence figure who's developing social credit. He's a student under Oraj. Oraj is also working with Gurdjieff, who's this occult espionage figure, who's also, you know, he's acting as his personal secretary. So you got that going on with Elon Musk's grandfather before he goes to South Africa. But the whole idea, again, is to create back then a thousand year occult psych of a high priesthood of elites that would manage the levers of production, consumption, thought, which was what Technocracy Inc. was all about. You know, like if they were successful, the idea was to just get rid of the system of sovereign nation states, get rid of the elected class, get rid of, you know, conventional capitalism as outdated things, and to be replaced by a new system of highly vetted experts to control society from above, which plays directly into it's like a proto transhuman thing, you know, and I mean, pulling it back a little bit further, this is what I think when you look at a lot of the preponderance of these groups in Silicon Valley and California, probably has a lot to do with Madame Blavatsky's call or her prediction, so-called, that the new root race, the sixth root race, will emerge in the West Coast of the United States. And specifically, she points out California, and it will be the Teutonic breed, which is sort of in her strange configuration of evolution, the sort of most advanced of the Aryan subroot races that's going to seed the new sixth root race, which is basically just a spiritualized materialism at the end of the day. But that will, you know, and that's Teutonic. That's this whole falls right into the Guido von List, Armin and order of Liebenfels and company, that I think, you know, all presumed that this, I mean, they had a whole Aryan Teutonic mythos that they created. Most of it's made like make believe. It's not even real. They just made it all up to convey the notion that this is the most spiritual of all types of humanity that are endowed by destiny to usher in this new age. So Peter Thiel coming out of South Africa, I don't think is a coincidence. A lot of the unreconstructed Nazis that continued their magic trick under NATO's protection, probably not a coincidence that they're all part of, you know, setting up and grooming Silicon Valley. The Valerian brothers that founded modern Silicon Valley grew out of the Cortona Lodge, Theosophical Lodge, which also set up most of Hollywood as we know it, which had a lot of Crowleyites in there from the get-go and before World War I even. So you got this like really nasty thing. It's kind of latched on like a parasite. The only thing I would differ on my analysis from David's, what David went through would be, I've got a much more positive view of the battle to create the sovereign nation state out of the Peace of Westphalia. And I also have been reading a lot of Moses Mendelssohn's writings over the years. His New Jerusalem book, for example, I read that twice, and I've been looking into also Lessing, who he was close friends with, and Schiller. I've been reading a lot of their writings, and I got to say, overall, I don't agree with that analysis that Mendelssohn was playing a negative role. It seems like he's fighting against this occult faction within Judaism and the Zionist movement in all of his writings and in his work. So I'm getting the sense he's a positive guy, and Westphalia is a positive thing. So on those two points, I would differ, but on everything else, I would agree.
Yeah, so just flesh out what you mean about the nation state, because surely this is at least a fairly, for us little minions here, you know, this is a good thing where you haven't got empires, you know, overrunning each other, that you've got a sort of a pact, really, agreed borders. At least that means that the ordinary people have got a bit of a better chance of surviving a few generations.
When I looked at the organization, like how Colbert and earlier Mazarin organized the Peace of Westphalia, like it wasn't an easy thing. It seemed like it took them years and years to try to get to some point of agreements around which this thing could be finally created sufficiently that the Protestant and the Catholic factions could agree to something that would end the Forever War, which itself is a Rosicrucian Jesuit operation. The Rosicrucians and Jesuits did the 30 Years' War from the get-go. And I don't think that they ever wanted it to necessarily end at any given time. It seemed like there was a big fight. But one of the key things that made it work was not that it was based on the like creating of new regional controls to respect each other's board, like boundary conditions. It wasn't really that. But in the first two articles of the Peace of Westphalia, the treaty, as far as its preamble, was this idea that the new type of these new nations, so-called, would be founded upon a principle of the benefit of the other, in that self-interest would be defined not from a Hobbesian zero-sum standpoint, which is where the empire always wants to keep us thinking about our self-identity in a zero-sum sort of mindset, but rather from the standpoint of the benefit of our neighbors and the forgiveness of all past transgressions, which is another very Christian principle that it's difficult to mandate positive principles. But when they come through in law, I kind of resonate with that. And also the third aspect was, I think, Colbertist, Dirigist programs of internal developments, which there were like, you can count them and measure the transformation of the treasuries from war making into, and speculation too, which was rampant, into massive internal improvements, like the Midzi Canal, the biggest infrastructure project in history that was overseen. It was begun by Mazarin, then continued by Colbert, with like thousands of roads and schools being built and sanitation projects. A lot of things that I don't think the oligarchy, I don't see any of the dominant players within the oligarchical dynamic helping that. I see, if anything, Colbert is like flushing the system of like the Duke of Guise and a lot of these high level Martinist and Rosicrucian types. Well, this is pre-Martinist. This is still Rosicrucian types who are running the deep state of France, who are being taken down by his program. So it just seems to me like a lot of, like when I look at the Congress of Vienna and the spheres of influence that came out of the Napoleonic Wars, that was not I don't see that as a heredity, like a spiritually hereditary evolution of Westphalia. I see that as like an abrogation or destruction of the Westphalian principle, or the Israeli idea of what a nation state was. I don't see that as being caused by Westphalia, but rather a doppelganger, perverse sort of zombie of what the nation state is that would justify its own eradication. So that's why I see the Westphalia nation state thing as overall, in principle, a good thing, although it could be infiltrated and turned into a bad thing. But right. I take a more nuanced approach there.
So, David, do you want to answer that briefly before we get up to date and round off?
Yeah, well, I'd like to come back to the point that, you know, the main thesis of my book on Zionism is that Zionism and Nazism are twin children of the Sabbatian movement, and the embryo is Moses Mendelssohn. The only historian that I know of who's done a detailed sort of conspiratorial study of the Sabbatian movement is Rabbi Marvin Antelman. He wrote a two-part book called To Eliminate the Opiate. And he discovered in a library in New York, I think it's the Schiff Collection of some sort, a document that had been collected by Moses Mendelssohn's best friend, which was Friedrich Nicolai. And Friedrich Nicolai was the chief publisher of the Illuminati movement. And that list, it was a list of ordinations. So basically a list of the purported successors of Shabbatai Zvi. And there were a number before Mendelssohn, but they listed Mendelssohn as the final case. So I know that Moses Mendelssohn appears to have been, you know, opposed to some of the mystical traditions of Judaism, but I believe that was some sort of dissimulation because his influence is recognized in his followers. And that is of two branches. So that's within Judaism, not just the Haskalah, but most of his disciples became leading members of the Asiatic Brethren, which was, again, a Frankist cult founded by the cousin of Jacob Frank, who then become leaders of the Frankfurt Union Lodge. And secondly, he was close to almost the entire circle of leaders of the Illuminati. So that's Herder, Schelling, Lessing. Fichte wasn't a proven member, but he was closely connected with the whole gang. He was even friends with Immanuel Kant. It goes on and on. Goethe, of course, was another leading member. And what's interesting is that what happens now is that it's so the branch that came through the Asiatic Brethren is the one that evolved into the Zionist movement. His friends in the Illuminati were the founders of what became German nationalism. Principally through Herder. Moses Mendelssohn's daughter, Dorothea, married Friedrich Schlegel, who is one of the most famous German historians of the time. He, historian, scientist slash philosophers, and he is the one who coined the term Aryan. And you can tell in his writing that he dropped hints that effectively connected the Aryans to descendants of Cain and Atlantis. And that's actually the first clue that led me to trace the occult origins of the Aryan legend. And it's from there that you have this parallel development. So Schlegel was linked to an entire network of Illuminists, also Martinists. I detail all that in my book. It's too many threads to follow. And basically, it's it was Herder who provided the justification, the idea of the veneration of language, and the language as being the language of the folk, as he referred to it, which he believed somehow carried the identity of a people or a folk. And so this is the idea that really fed the early birth of German nationalism, and then it was carried forth by people like Fichte. And then you have one of the most important exponents. So everything takes place really in Weimar and the University of Jena. So the Weimar, what they call Weimar classicism, so the city of Weimar. And that is a movement sponsored by Karl August of Sachs Weimar Eisenach. And he was a family now who could trace descent all the way back to they claimed descent back to the night swan, which is why the swan was so important. This is an important symbol in their dynastic identity. According to Houston Stuart Chamberlain, who was Wagner's son-in-law, Wagner was a little bit child of Carl August's niece, which is why Wagner picked on the legend of the Night Swan, which, of course, he reportedly could claim descent from, and that became one of the most important mythic symbols of his work. And you look at Wagner, he was basically part of an entire circle of people who were affiliated with the Frankfurt Judenlodge, particularly Giacomo Meyerbeer. His father was one of the founders of the... This is where you come back now to the Hamburg Temple. And Hamburg Temple is basically the origin of where Reform Zionism gave its birth before evolving eventually into Zionism. So this whole Wagner network, Hamburg Temple, this is why Wagner eventually then becomes really the chief ideologue, inspired guru, basically, of the German nationalistic movement, which effectively was a Frankist movement. So out of the University of Vienna, this is where you get the founding of the Burschenschaft. The Burschenschaft is basically the German university system, and it becomes the birthplace of the German nationalist movement. One of the founding figures is a guy named Father Jan. He was a member of a group called the Tugendbund, and the Tugendbund was named after an order of the same name founded by Moses Mendelssohn. And so again, this is how you get the birth of nationalism. So it's this entire network which basically feeds and produces German nationalism, which overlaps with various occult societies like Bull Relitin and the occult revival and the, you know, Guido von List and so on, especially somebody like George von Schirnerer, who turns out to have been basically a Rothschild descendant as well. And and most importantly, so George von Schirnerer becomes sort of like a leading, guiding figure, ideologue of this Burschenschaft movement, and that's where Theodor Herzl gets his start. Theodor Herzl joins the Burschenschaft in Vienna and becomes part of this Burschenschaft circle, and this is where he starts leaning towards German idealism, as well as most of that movement. They belong to a group called the Pernestorfer Circle, who were affiliated with this, basically another key movement in German nationalism. And it was made up mostly of Jews, people like Mahler, Gustav Mahler, another member of the Theosophical Society, Freud. There's the Adler family. And of course, Herzl wasn't quite a member, but he was affiliated with that group. So and what happens is there's a split from that point where the Frankist or the Jewish members sort of split off from the more overtly racist branch. But this is how you get these twin branches. So one becomes more overtly anti-Semitic, and then you have the other group, which is a basically Frankist group. And this is how you get the branches sort of separate, one developing into Zionism and the one into Zionism. But you can see, Nazism, but you can, as we talked about earlier, there's constant overlap between the two groups, and that's what we're living, and that's why Elon Musk sported a Nazi salute at the inauguration.
Well, look, I'm going to have to drag you right up to today, folks, and I wonder if within about 5 or 10 minutes each, you could both give us your view on modern the opening of 2026 is almost like a 12-gun salute, really, with the street fighting, rioting, applauded around the Western media over in Tehran and other cities in Iran, as well as the amazing kind of taking hostage of Nicolas Maduro from Venezuela by Donald Trump, and the sort of general feeling that's coming out of Trump, which is in his little speeches where he says, actually, international law doesn't really matter anymore. Anyway, it's just whatever you think it might be and however I interpret it. And actually, I am only limited in US foreign policy now by my own morality, by my own mind. That's the only thing which is limiting it. And, we've had headlines here. I was looking at one of the newspapers here today saying British armed forces braced for an attack on Iran from the United States, with the British embassy being closed yesterday and bringing all the forces back from certain places that they think might be the victims of retaliation by Iran if and when the United States strikes Iran. And then we hear this morning, oh, no, it's OK. Nothing's going to happen. It's all fine. So you've got all these headlines in front of you saying that there's going to be an attack because of a big uprising in Iran. So anyway, we're living in this very much an Orwellian world where no one's supposed to really know what's going on, and everything is very contradictory. So what do you first, Matt, what do you make of the opening of 26?
Well, unfortunately, it's going to be a very character building experience, that's for sure. I do think that there is something to the interpretation of Alice Bailey's externalization of the hierarchy program. Whether she said 2025, that may be partially true, but I think that you are seeing in a certain sense the more subterranean elements that had created a nested series of wind up automatons, these sort of like nested games within games, ideological shells that kind of have their own flow to them once you wind them up and get them going. But they don't need that much input or direct intervention by the causal nexus of those high priests who put them into motion. Except now I think we're beginning to see a more active influence by that I guess, you know, that Rosicrucian subterranean force. That very old evil is kind of coming to the surface in a more active way, which is where people's ability to discern reality from fantasy, from fiction, is becoming consciously undone. And it took a lot of decades of hypnotic induction and massaging of the zeitgeist through Hollywood and other forms of so-called entertainment and the drug culture. You know, and our whole culture is pretty much weaponized, and it's been that way for before all three of us were born, right? Not to say it's all shit, but there's a lot of crap that's designed specifically to destroy our ability to use our sovereign reasoning faculties and to be more susceptible to becoming absorbed by the game that they've put into motion. So I think we're at a place right now where there is an acceleration of that. My concern right now is it seems as though, you know, there is sort of like a secret Yalta or Congress of Vienna type of operation that has been like there's an underdefined operating system that's going to replace the currently collapsing time bomb that was once an economy. But I mean, our economy has become a time bomb that has been detonated to collapse. It can't be saved. There will be a new system. And I think there's a fight over like what will be the characteristics of that new system or who will it serve. And, you know, so I get the sense that there has been a embrace of, or we're sort of at that transitionary period, like the Rome was with maybe the death of Julius Caesar and the onset of a new set of civil wars that pulled Rome into, was it 15 years of civil war, out of which that pulverized society would be more susceptible to accepting something unacceptable to the former society pre-Caesar that still had certain aspirations of republican values to hold on to. And after that bloodbath, people were much more pliable. And the idea of, you know, Emperor Octavio Augustus, who was itself, it seems from my research, cut a deal with certain high priests from the cult of Mithra on the Isle of Capri to establish Rome instead of Alexandria as the new capital of this new type of society, which is, you know, pretty much good old Babylon, but with a bit more projective power in the form of the empire, with a new, more sanctified set of active priests, like cults, these, you know, Isis and Sibel Attis and Mithra, which had formerly not been in as governing of a role as they were after this point. They became more of a top-down managerial thing within the new system of controlling Pantheon and its Roman variations of this occult system. So my concern right now is that we're sort of at one of these types of millennial shifting points, and I don't see nearly as much resistance to it as I was hoping there might be at this point. I'm hoping to God that, you know, saner heads can prevail over the case in Iran, where I do think that the greater Israel ideologues are genuinely licking their lips to get that big trophy they've been aching for so many years, Iran, to be taken down so that they could eliminate whatever resistance is currently kind of making it annoying for Israel to just go full on with its massive accelerated expansion to establish greater Israel as pretty much occupying the borders. If you look at the maps that are acknowledged, as the covenant, the actualized covenant made by Moses and God, which involves pretty much the Neo-Babylonian empire of Nebuchadnezzar. It's pretty much the exact same borders that they want to reestablish during those years that the Jews were in captivity in Babylon, except now under a new name. And I do think that, you know, that a big part for me of the clues of how this is wired involves, you know, Eichmann and Himmler's support both for the most radical Zionist faction. I mean, you know, Eichmann taught himself Hebrew so that he could practice Kabbalah. And he said in an interview that, and I don't even think he was killed, though they say he was. He said in an interview, if I had been a Jew, I would have been the most radical Zionist imaginable. I don't know how you could be anything other, which sounds a lot like Crowley saying, you know, of course I believe in Darby and premillennial dispensationalism. I don't see how anybody could believe in any other thing. He just took on the role of the Antichrist. These same guys who are pushing Zionism in Nazi Germany are also at the same time pushing Haj Amin, the British, you know, genocidalist who's overseeing and is craving the total destruction of the Jews and, frankly, is more than willing to kill most of his own Muslim people at the same time, who's working with Hitler and getting support to create this pro-Nazi Arab army. So I think it's part of the ritual is just get, you know, create a situation whereby the Arabs and the Jews living in that region pretty much annihilate each other and reinstate the Kingdom of Jerusalem under a technocratic sort of or a transhuman sort of new rebranding of the same old, same old. That's unfortunately how I see the orientation. And I hope that I could be proven wrong. But that's the trend.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Matt. David, what do you make of the? I mean, for me, it's so weird looking at this from a journalistic point of view to see. Well, we could see the opening shots of World War III tonight, and then you wake up in the morning and Donald Trump has decided no.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on. I never know what's going on short term. I don't think we can. You know, we know what their goals are long term. It's short term that's the struggle to figure out. But yeah. I think back to your point that you made, Matt, about Palantir being funded by Intutel, which is a CIA front. And so, what's curious is that it was Palantir. So when Cambridge Analytica wanted to breach, steal all the Facebook profiles, it was Palantir who showed them how to do it. But of course, Peter Thiel was also was the earliest funder of Facebook in the first place. And so that was all part of this is what I detail in my book, Order of Cal, was a part of a pretty elaborate operation. It was publicized as a Russian operation, but it was really an Israeli operation to use Russian hackers, use the Russian mafia, which is a Jewish mafia, which use Russian hackers to create or to accelerate memes produced by Discordian pranksters to divide and conquer the United States and create mobilize support for Donald Trump, which it seems to have worked. The architect of that mission, I believe, was Alexander Dugin, and he is basically the modern leader. I'm suspecting of the Luciferian International, the modern leader of the Martinist tradition, who's out to create what he calls the empire of the end times, fulfilling the prophecy of Nostradamus, which aligns with the whole mythos of the Priory of Zion, which was inspired by the teachings of his two mentors, which were Raymond de Bellio and Jean Parvulescu. To go on a bit of a tangent, Raymond de Bellio was a friend of Antoine Pinay, who was the founder of two key organizations. One of them was the Bilderberg conferences, and then a year apart, he founded the Pinay Circle, which became the umbrella of the Fascist International. And this is where, how with branches in South America, South Africa, which is how I believe Peter Thiel and his network is implicated. So, you know, this, and the Fascist International was behind the Gladio operation. It was working closely with rogue agents of the CIA, particularly Ted Shackley's secret team, who had been involved in the JFK assassination, then moved on to the Golden Triangle heroin trade in Southeast Asia. Then they moved on to Iran-Contra. And it's largely most of the felons of the Iran-Contra linked closely with the neoconservatives, which has basically been the architects of the foreign policy in the last couple of decades. And this all goes back to a conference organized by Netanyahu in 1979, known as the Jerusalem Conference, when he effectively dictated to this entire network of the Circle and neoconservatives that they knew the new enemy was going to be terrorism. And that's how the invasion and support of the so-called jihad in Afghanistan was justified. And of course, leading all the way up to 9/11. And that in sum is pretty much the history that we've been living. So effectively, you know, it's coming back to the whole idea of the protocols. The protocols were disseminated, popularized by a guy named Boris Brassall, who worked for William Wiseman, I think is what his name was, who was the head of British intelligence at the time, and was linked to the Kuhn Lode Bank. And Kuhn Lode Bank is basically the network that connected the Warburgs and Jacob Schiff to that whole crowd, basically the ruinous, honest crowd. Of course, they were the fundies of the Nazis. And Boris Brassall, he was part of an organization called the Aufbau, which is active in Germany, consisting largely of white Russians. And they're the ones, this is the organization that introduced the Thule Society to the protocols, which is how Hitler and Alfred Rosenberg in particular was introduced to the protocols, and it became what Norm Cohn called, it was a warrant for genocide. So it basically became a scheme to use this perception of a global communist and Jewish conspiracy to rally the Germans to oppose, you know, the Jews, which in this case, what they meant was not the Rothschilds and Warburgs that they were receiving funding from, but, you know, the poor shopkeepers and the ghetto Jews that the Zionists had traditionally been very much in opposition to, the Ostjuden, as they refer them to. And so Boris Brassall then comes to the United States, and he becomes the brain trust, as he's been, was referred to, of the America First Committee. Out of the America First Committee, you get the ASC, and then the American Security Council, and that's really the birth of the American right. The ASC teams up with the John Birch Society, with the Klan, and Ted Shackley's secret team to become the conspirators behind the assassination of JFK. And that's basically so this cabal that came over with Boris Brassall, this that developed through these committees, this is, they basically were underground for many, many decades. And you can see how much power they exercised, particularly at the Regnery family. But they never...
Which family?
Regnery. Regnery. They're still to this day the chief sponsors of the conservative movement. The Regnery Publishing is the main publishing arm for all these sort of right-wing crackpots like Ann Coulter and this whole bunch, like David Horowitz. They're all published by Regnery. Regnery was also he also funded Richard B. Spencer to found, I can't remember what it was, but, you know, Richard B. Spencer, the alt-right guy. So they effectively funded the alt-right as well. And so they had been struggling for many decades, all the way back to the 50s, trying to gain power in the United States. And the first person that they finally succeeded in doing so was Donald Trump. And they did so with the same MO as Hitler did, as basically pointing to a conspiracy that's rotting inside the government that needed to be overthrown. They used Trump as their mouthpiece to accomplish it, when in fact he's the agent of the deep state as opposed to its opponent.
Fascinating. And also, of course, I was entertained in a weird way watching all the court cases against Trump rumbling on in 2023 and 24, oh, well, 22 and 23, where you could see that this was increasing his popularity. You know, any genuine opponent would be saying, well, let's just drop this. It's not working, you know. But no, the court cases continued against Trump. And as did his popularity increase, it seems really obvious to me that, you know, he's been created as a sort of, you know, fake person who's against the deep state, you know, and he's got his own mind to a certain extent. But, you know, he's having his strings pulled. And also, of course, he's very wedded through Jared Kushner, et cetera, to the Zionist plans and the, you know, the Greater Israeli expansion plans. So anyway, look. Thank you, guys. I think that's quite enough. I've kept you on the line for far too long. So maybe, Matt, you could just start by letting listeners know whereabouts they can find your work and follow you online, and maybe mention a couple of your books as well.
Yeah, sure. And thank you for pulling this together, Tony. And I had a great I can honestly say that I've never taken as many notes in one of these roundtable conversations as I have in today's session. David, we should meet up and have a beer. And
I was thinking the same,
yeah. Yeah, I think it's over. Yeah, it's overdue, and we're like kind of close, so yeah. Might as well just yeah. Because there's so many things I'd want to have follow up questions for you on. And again, thank you for giving me tons of leads here to work on.
Right.
Yeah, for people listening, if they want to look more into my work, my books, The Untold History of Canada, The Clash of the Two Americas series, The Science Unshackled book, or The Revenge of the Mystery Cults, or my wife's books as well, On the Making of a World Religion, or The Black Sun, The Empire in Which the Black Sun Never Set, that's all available on CanadianPatriot.org. Pretty easy to find, along with regular updates and our documentaries that we're doing, including exposing the Rosicrucian hands behind the UFO psyop that's accelerating now. All that stuff is mostly available for free to watch. And my Substack, I put out stuff almost every day, mostly free. That's MatthewErritt.substack.com.
And David?
Thanks, Tony. So yeah, my website is ordoabcal.ca. So that's where I, it's basically the sort of the main hub where I keep all the information about myself and my research. You can find links to all my books there. Three of them are on the site itself as web pages. So that's Ordoabcal, the Zionism book, and my most recent Divide and Conquer. I don't do Facebook anymore. I don't do any other social media. I only do Patreon. So I welcome anyone who's interested to join me there. That's where I share some of my recent findings, my observations on what is happening and things like that. So thank you very much.
Yeah, Your Dying God is, I think, really fascinating. For me, it did something which no book has ever done, David, which is to carry this right the way back thousands of years to start to look at, actually maybe Margaret Murray did a similar thing, to look at some of the roots of today's problems in thousands of years ago. But anyway, both of you, thanks very much for joining us.
Excellent. Thanks again for putting together, and great to meet you and talk with you, Matt.
All right, likewise.
So that's Matt Errett and David Livingston. The full version of that will be up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. I called it Armageddon's Stage Managers and the Secret Nazi Script. So that's, to me, you know, we can't really do these ordinary individual little news items without understanding really the bigger picture. This Pax Judaica quite clearly is happening in the home front and abroad. Everywhere there is a Zionist cult which is infiltrated all elite institutions pretty much, and is doing its best to take us to war. So we need to be quite concerned about, particularly about looking at links to the Nazis, as David Livingston has dug up so much through the Wagner's circle and the people that later from those Zionists then popped up as early Nazis. So it's a war on God, but God's going to win. Time to sign off. Thanks very much to the guests, particularly Matt Errett and David Livingston. We also interviewed Jackie Devoy this week about her new book, Murdered by the State. Didn't have time for that, but we'll have that next week. Do please share interviews and story tips on my Tony Gosling Censored Telegram group, on WhatsApp, and my Facebook page with me if you like. And you can download this show and full-length interviews, subscribe to my weekly newsletter. You can donate or even set up a small monthly sub. Thanks if you already do. And that's all at the show page this week, oneword.org.uk. This is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the stream, except 5 p.m. Monday to Thursday, when we bring you the Richie Allen Show live. We're streaming from Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, holylandradio.com from 11 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. Central Time, 87.7 FM in West Sweden, Wisconsin, if you happen to be passing through or live there, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream this show live or rebroadcast it, let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the Bristol Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless. Do a good deed every day. And don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
del quinto centenario.
Straight in at number three on the DJ's choice, and most of the tracks in the charts are upbeat house records, and it's no real surprise because, as we know, Amsterdam is house nation of the world.